across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd. Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Evening, good day, welcome, hello, Tommy here. Ian is not here, he's well and enjoying himself in that part of the country which, often the butt of jokes, isn't it, Wales? I'm not going to go there because it's too easy and because it's not particularly funny. But we will probably descend into cliche and various other shameful acts of broadcasting as the evening develops. Kathy's here.
That's the connection. That's where we go to the cliche and the outrageousness.
I think, how long is he going to be away for?
I'm just here for
the week. Yeah. And he's gone away with some buddies and he's enjoying but just being in the country. He's not listening.
No, he won't listen.
Are you sure?
He can't listen.
Why?
Because he won't allow himself to.
Okay.
He gets antsy.
You see, he's turning into quite a giant on the British broadcasting scene, Ian Lee, because even when he's not here, he sort of shadows across the programme like the 6'8" giant. I didn't realise until quite recently when I met Ian for the first time just what an enormous specimen he is. Mm. You know, if he'd been a rugby player, then England could have put him to some good use the other Saturday, Sunday.
He would have been useful for getting in the way, but he's really not the most sporting of people.
No, I can see that. Okay, well, good evening to you listening. If you're listening live, hi, good evening. If you're listening on a podcast, good day. If you're just catching up. We're going to be talking inevitably about what is, I think, one of the most rich, varied, exciting, interesting, terrifying news episodes I can remember in my all too long and occasionally illustrious broadcasting stroke journalistic career, and that is Russia, Salisbury, spies, Putin, World War III, chemical weapons. It's got so many aspects to it that it's going to run and run and run. Now, the first thing I want to say is that Kath informs me that the conspiracy community are already beginning to get hold of it.
Absolutely. They've commented on how little we know about the status of the victims from Salisbury now.
Yeah, we haven't seen any photographs. We have to take it. If you're a conspiracy theorist, you're able to say, why have we not seen pictures of them in an oxygen tent or whatever?
Why do we not know how they are now?
The reason for that, of course, is because they're fighting for their lives and cameras don't play any part, do they, as far as we know, in improving the body condition.
But how would we know if they were still alive?
OK, this is what conspiracy theorists are already. Mm-hmm. Is that kind?
No.
When people are fighting for their lives?
No, but you'd have to believe that they were fighting for their
lives. Tubes coming out of every part mm-hmm. of them at death's door, literally. And there are three of them, of course, not just two Russian citizens, but a British police officer. And I suppose his involvement in this episode, and again, we should remember that he's fighting for his life and we should remember his family, but I suppose the conspiracy theorists are already making stuff and nonsense out of his involvement.
How do we know he's real?
Yes, they will. And why is it not known whether he attended the scene that the two were found at, the park bench, the mythological park bench in Salisbury now, or he went to the home of Skripal, Sergei Skripal? Do you know what I did? Which is a bit quasi-conspiracy theorist.
Did you check some facts, Tommy?
I went on 118118. And he's in the phone book. He's in the phone book. You can get his phone book and his address. This is a man who was sentenced to 10 years by a Russian court for betraying his country and selling secrets to MI5. One rumour is that he earned £100,000 over a period of time from our coffers for passing on secrets which may have included the identities of some Russian spies who were functioning in the United States. So I suppose another conspiracy theory might be that a la Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, if you've ever read it, I've read it twice. I still don't quite get it. But anyway, it's quite possible that a spy who was betrayed will seek revenge.
I've had our first but via Twitter.
Go on.
You were talking about how we wouldn't see someone who was gravely ill and fighting for their lives.
Yeah.
Marcus says, please point out to Tommy that we saw pictures of Alexander Litvinenko when he was gravely ill.
True. That's a good point. He was, of course, conscious. And he wanted to say what he said. Any pictures, Marcus? Do you want to see pictures? What would you see? I would assume that a person who has suffered such an invasive attack as by a nerve agent isn't going to be necessarily recognisable anyway. I don't know. I mean, what do you look like if you've ingested, either absorbed or inhaled or drank or eaten, this Novichok agent? And it was in the interest of all concerned for Litvinenko to be photographed. The previous victim of anything such like by the then KGB was Georgi Markov in 1979, I think, who was killed as a result of an umbrella. He was killed by umbrella.
Is that the one on Westminster Bridge?
Yeah. Yeah, he was poked in the back of the leg by a sharp umbrella. He went, ouch, and then thought no more of it. And what had happened was the umbrella was used to fire a tiny pellet containing a toxin into the back of his leg, which eventually took his life. Yeah, remind people of the ways in which they can contact the programme, if you would, Kath. And thanks for your text, Marcus.
Probably the best way to do it is to give us a call, which is 0344 499 1000. That's 0344 499 1000. You can text talk and your message to 87222. That's 25p plus your standard message rate. But to be honest, this is kind of a talk show, and the conversation we're having is quite complicated. I'd rather you rang us up.
I couldn't agree more. Whenever I'm standing in for somebody doing their show, I always sort of split the difference between being myself, how could you not, but also ensuring that the show still sounds like the show that the person that I'm standing in for would be doing.
Well, we wouldn't be doing this.
Oh, wouldn't we?
Nah.
Okay. Oh, well.
So go for broke, do you?
Oh, no. Well, I'll split the difference, as I said before. We're going to be talking then about the Salisbury thing and about the conspiracy theories that are on their way. And I do think that it could end up being a conspiracy theory right up then, perhaps not 9/11 proportions or lunar landing proportions or even JFK, but up there. You know, because what I'm driving at is I don't think we'll ever know what happened. I don't think we'll ever know.
Do you think we need to?
Yes. Desperately. That's why you're a conspiracy theorist, because you want to know the truth. And if you do know the truth...
I mean, do we need to? I know we want to, but do we need to?
Yes. Why would we not need to?
Machinations of power. Will
I
we
love
ever
the word
the
machinations.
Truth?
It's 10 minutes past 10. Let's take our first call. I believe we've got Andre on the line from Essex. Andre, good evening.
Evening, Tommy. All right. Yeah, this is not exactly along the same lines, but similar. Because I've got a bit of an illness at the moment. I'm not really one to go on about things like this, hangovers, headaches and all that. But I've got food poisoning, as far as that you know. And I can't go 5 minutes from my house for the last 3 days. And it's going to last 7 days. And I'm really gutted about it, and I feel sick. Because I just can't go without leaving the brilliant bathroom. All right? Now, what do you suggest I do?
I suggest that...
Allow
me to help you. I presume what you're saying is that you're loose.
Loose? It's got a brilliant fountain.
All right, well, we don't want the details.
All right, no, you're loose. Sorry.
Okay. All right. First of all, you're going to need to rehydrate.
Yeah,
and I believe
that
they sell a proprietary brand of something in most chemists or pharmacies called Dyrolite.
That's right.
That's what it's. Sorry, I pronounced it wrong. That's what I've got. Yeah.
Also, I suggest that where do you live exactly in Essex, Andre?
Near South End.
Are you well served there by herbalist?
I thought he was going to say my work well served by barmen and women.
Well, we all know the answer to that.
Yeah, I've got lots of plenty of chemists around.
Right, what I'm going to put you on to, have you got a pen?
Yeah.
Okay, you don't need it. I just wanted to check that you got a pen. That's good to know. No, here you are. I want you to write this down, right? Psyllium husks.
Pardon?
P-S-Y.
P-S-Y, yeah.
S-I-L-L-U-M. Husks.
P-S-Y, sorry.
Psyllium husks. P-S-Y-S-I-L-L-U-M. Husks.
Husks. Are they good?
Yes. What you do is you spoon a teaspoon of psyllium husks into a cup and you cover it then. They recommend with fruit juice, but I'm happy to take it with ordinary water.
Yeah.
And then it forms into a gel.
Mm-hmm.
And then you consume it.
Yeah.
Either glug it down or with a teaspoon.
And
the following morning, I guarantee that you will produce a world-class stool.
Do you reckon?
Yes. No, I'm certain of it.
Have you tried it?
I'm never off it.
Oh.
The ideal stool, as prescribed in...
The Bristol stool scale.
The Bristol stool scale. Is there a...
There is.
Is there? Tell us about the ideal stool.
The Richter scale.
There is a Richter scale of stools. You may laugh. Well, I wouldn't in your condition, to be honest, but let me tell you. But it describes each and every one. So from the, you know, the ones that look like revels.
Just keep going.
All the way down to the ones that you're experiencing at the moment in terms of looseness.
Yeah.
But the best one, you know, as prescribed by Gillian McKeith, is, you know, your comedy poo, the one that looks like a sausage.
The ideal stool is about 9 inches long.
Nine?
It's slightly curved.
Blimey.
It's tapered at either end. And this is crucial. And this is crucial. If it is a perfectly healthy stool, the healthiest stool you can get, it floats.
Well, so I'll tell you what my unhealthiest stool was the minute I woke up this morning.
No.
Thank you, Andre, for your call. That's absolutely all. Nice to talk to you. We'll talk to you again sometime.
It was definitely a type 7.
Yes. Okay, we've got a big queue of calls. Shall we rattle through a few before we take our first commercial break and then our first global interview of the evening? Blake is next in Surrey. Good evening, Blake. Thank you for calling.
Good evening, Tommy. How are we?
We're well. You?
Good, yeah, good. Thank you. I think I haven't really kind of read the full details. I've seen the headlines and I've heard regular kind of news updates over the radio and so on. And it seems to me like Theresa May wants to start what could be World War III.
Why would she want to do that?
Because, it was always going to happen at some point, wasn't it? But blaming the Russians is extremely dangerous. And it's either them or the British government have done it to stir things up. And I don't know why she's done it, but I think she's got some kind of theory behind it. There's some method in the madness.
Okay, so your concern is that the British Prime Minister herself might have instructed that a mysterious toxic agent be used on a Russian spy who's come to live in this country in order to provoke World War III, which will help her, I'm still not quite clear on that bit, by...
Well, when you put it like that, it sounds ludicrous. But at the same time...
Thank you. That's because it is.
they're also trying to tackle childhood going off on a slight tangent. They're also trying to tackle childhood obesity. And when I was sort of 12, I had a leisure card where I could go to my local leisure centre and use it, swimming, you know, tennis, anything like that. And they cut that, so they kind of constrict themselves in that. So in the same way, it might seem at the moment slightly ridiculous, but then they've made silly decisions in the past. The Conservative Party is the hell, but maybe this is something that she's trying to make a mark as a Prime Minister by doing.
Yes. Are you, if I may ask this, Blake, old enough to vote?
Yes.
You are. Well,
I'm 21.
Hope that the Cambridge Academia don't know how to get hold of you. Because you sound to me vulnerable. Thank you for your call.
Okay.
Talk to you again sometime. We're discussing Salisbury and Russia and spies and chemical agents. We're discussing what used to be called the KGB, but now I believe they're called the FFS, and the CIA, and MI5 and MI6, which you don't often get lumped together, but because this is an issue that affects our spying on other people in this country, which is what MI5 does, and our spying on people in other countries, which is what MI6 does, then we're practically quorate, I think. KGB, let me do it again. KGB, MI5, MI6, CIA, Moscow, London, Washington, and a chemical agent. I mean, you know, throw in Robbie Savage and you've got yourself a show.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd. Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Hey, Tommy Boyd looking after things for Ian Lee. Kath is here. This evening, at some point, we will no doubt talk about Ant of Ant and Dec, the Cirque du Soleil and circuses in general, perhaps. There's been the first self-drive car fatality in the United States. There have been fatalities before involving such vehicles, but this is the first occasion on which a car being driven on the open highway by a computer has tragically caused the death of a pedestrian. So that's something that we ought to talk about. Amongst the many things that he said just before he passed away, Stephen Hawking said that we should be planning now to live on other planets, partly because of the threat that he perceives will come from artificial intelligence. And I think it's also worth lending a thought or two to Michael Gove's threat to ban shock collars for dogs. But most of all, we're looking at this enormously rich potential conspiracy theory concerning Salisbury, spies, the CIA, MI5, the British government, toxic chemicals, and of course the KGB, or now the FFS, and the Kremlin. And when you say the Kremlin in this day and age, you mean Vladimir Putin. He went to the Nation. He's got himself another 6 years. Let's find out what's going on over in that part of the world at the moment. I think we can talk to Brian McDonald, who is a journalist based in Russia. Brian, good evening. What's the mood like, the mood been like in Moscow today?
Much the same as it was yesterday and the day before. I mean, it's just a continuation, really. For most people, I mean, the result was expected. There was hardly a shock. It wasn't exactly a cliffhanger that had people up in the middle of the night. All opinion polls for years have shown Putin to have by far the highest approval rating of any politician in Russia. And, you know, despite the fact that the second-place candidate, Pavel Grudinin from the Communist Party, did better than expected, you know, the result was pretty much a foregone conclusion, and it's no surprise that Putin has won over 70% of the vote.
Mm. Yeah, the Communists picked up 11%, didn't they? The Lib Dems in this country would be pleased with that, but it didn't knock a dent at all in the man in charge.
No.
Who's an independent?
It was a bad result for them, considering in the previous election they scored closer to 20%.
Yeah.
So it was, but the previous candidate and official party leader Gennady Zhukanov had been polling at something ridiculous like 3 or 4%. So they changed their front man, you know, a matter of months before the election, which didn't really give the guy much time to gain traction.
Now, Putin's down as an independent, and to even be able to stand as an independent, there's quite a complex qualification process, isn't there?
You need 400,000 signatures to run in Russia, yeah. I mean, if a party that has representation in the Duma backs you, you don't need any. And if you've got a party with a smaller representation, then you need a smaller amount, which I think off the top of my head is close to 100,000. That's how Ksenia Sobchak did it. She had the backing of the City Platform movement, and that reduced the number she needed. In Vladimir Putin's case, he needed that considerable amount I mentioned earlier, and obviously very easily obtained it, because despite the fact that he was running as an independent, let's be honest here, he had the tacit approval of United Russia, the party he co-founded with Dmitry Medvedev a decade and a half ago. And obviously, they didn't run a candidate against him, which meant that, you know, despite the fact that he was listed as independent, he was, you know, to all intents and purposes, the United Russia candidate.
Now, you mentioned Medvedev. Putin played a beautiful game of chess when his first term as president came up, because he installed Medvedev as president, didn't he? So he could continue to run the country as prime minister, which fitted how things were with the constitution then.
It's a little bit more complicated than that. It's not as simplistic as to say that they just played a game of musical chairs, despite what you might read in certain outlets. I mean, in fact, today, even just today, on Russian media, they've been talking about why Putin decided to come back in 2012, because some people in 2008 genuinely believed he was going to step aside. And a lot of people even now think that he wanted to step aside at the time. A lot of people say that when Medvedev decided to support the Western position on Libya, in 2011, which led to the overthrow of Gaddafi, that was the moment Putin decided that he was going to come back to office. To say that Medvedev didn't have control is not really true, because, I mean, Dmitry Medvedev, when he came to power in 2008, he did remove a lot of Vladimir Putin's cronies from, you know, the first administration. He appointed his own director of the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB and, you know, equivalent to the FBI in Russia. He appointed his own man there, removing Putin's own favorite. He did, as I said, adopt a contrarian policy when it came to Libya. He refused to veto the UN resolution on the no-fly zone, which led to the toppling of the Gaddafi regime. And so it's not entirely fair to say that Dmitry Medvedev didn't have his own, you know, power base at the time. And, you know, I'm not saying that it is very possible that Vladimir Putin was always going to come back, but it's not fair to say that he was in complete control during those years.
Well, if this is his last stint, then he'll be grooming a successor at some point. That's what always happens. How likely, is there any likelihood at all, that his successor as president of Russia might be one of the key men who are behind his power base at the moment, who himself is a billionaire, who himself has considerable experience in politics, but is currently best known as the owner of Chelsea Football Club?
Oh, it's not a hope of Roman Abramovich. No, there's no hope for that, sorry. His only political experience extends to a period as the governor of Chukotka. And Chukotka is one of the most remote parts of the United Kingdom, of Russian Federation. You got me confused there. It's over bordering Alaska in the northeast of the country. It's a very sparsely populated place.
It's got a bit of gas and oil, but...
It wouldn't matter. Putin's likely successor is very possible that someone with money behind him could take over. There are people like Igor Sechin, who's the all-powerful boss of Rosneft, for example, a huge state oil company. He's certainly a plausible successor, but his age would go against him. What is likely is that, let's just extend this point a little bit. To get into Vladimir Putin's head, which is something that's not very much discussed in Britain or the West, Putin sees himself as a living historical figure, and he sees himself in a way as the savior of Russia. That means that Putin will want to leave behind a sustainable legacy after him. Parachuting in someone as divisive as Roman Abramovich is not going to work, for the simple reason that the people just wouldn't swallow it. What's likely to happen is that if he's going to go down the road of picking a straight successor, or as he would put it, recommending a successor, he's very likely to go for someone at least 20 years younger than himself. And that would be somebody who's currently in their late 30s or early 40s. Okay. In order to give that person enough time to, you know, stabilize the system. One of the mistakes, as you probably remember, or maybe you don't, but many people would remember, is that after Leonid Brezhnev died in the early 80s, he didn't leave a successor. And what happened afterwards was that the Soviet Union went through three leaders in as many years. I mean, first it was Andropov, then Chernenko, and then Gorbachev. And Putin will not want something like that to happen, something as destabilizing.
Well, two out of the four recent names then have been KGB, because Andropov was head of the KGB, and we know that...
Medvedev wasn't the head of the KGB.
Who wasn't?
Medvedev was from the KGB, because he was a lawyer.
Andropov was.
Andropov was, that's right, yeah, definitely. And Andropov,
and Putin
in some ways,
is.
Was Putin's role model.
Yeah. So we could look towards what used to be the KGB for Russia's next president.
Well, that's an interesting point, because obviously one of the feelings in the 90s was that after the oligarchs had taken control of the country, that Putin's arrival on the scene was the KGB guys, if you like, taking control back, taking the reins of the country back. So it is very possible somebody from that background or somebody from security services, like the governor of Tula, Duyman, for example, could come in. But it's more plausible that he will go for a technocrat. Another theory you hear often in Russia is that, again, I don't want to drag the point too long, but one of the reasons Putin has so much power is because in 1993, with Western support, may I add, especially from Bill Clinton, who described him as the equivalent of Abraham Lincoln, Boris Yeltsin was able to kind of demolish Russia's, the strength of Russia's parliament, and introduce what is known as a super presidential system, which Putin has obviously benefited from. It gives huge power, far more power than the British prime minister has, more akin to what a monarch may have had in you know, previous centuries in the United Kingdom. But one of the ideas going around is that Putin may decide to demolish that system for the transition and move back to a more parliamentary system. That's also very plausible.
Finally, was Salisbury brought up at all on the campaign trail, if there is a campaign trail for Putin at election time, or did he only refer to it when asked?
It didn't really come up. Again, without going into too much detail, one of the reasons some elements of the British media have got this story wrong and how it affected the Russian election is because, to be honest, the two victims are nobodies in Russia in the sense they don't have a huge profile. So when the attack happened at first, it wasn't really a headline story in Russia. I mean, I was looking at the news media all week that week, and you know, it was mentioned, of course, but it wasn't the main story. The main story was the elections, to be honest with you, and various other domestic issues. It became a story in Russia after Britain sanctioned Russia with the expulsion of the diplomats, the 24 diplomats. That's when it became a story, and that's when it became relevant to the election campaign.
Listen, thanks very much indeed for your time this evening, Brian McDonald in Russia.
No bother. Thanks very much. Have a good evening.
The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
So a number of things this evening on the agenda, but we're staying in this first hour largely with two things. One is the international standoff situation between the United Kingdom and now large parts of the Western world, and Putin's Russia. And we're also talking about stomach disorders, thanks to Andre calling at the beginning of the programme and betraying that he's had some sort of gastric flu for the last 3 or 4 days and asking whether anybody can advise. Just before we go to Barry, thank you for calling, Barry. Chris has SMS to say that the more this goes on, he's referring to Salisbury, the more the official version of events does not add up. That's, I've verbalised capital letters there. And the more sceptical I have become. But Barry's on the line from Romford with some thoughts for Andre. Barry.
Yeah, hello. I'm sorry I'm not talking about Putin or Andropov, as that gentleman referred to him as.
He did, didn't he?
Yeah, I love the way he said that. It's about, that chap who had, not to put too fine a point on it, diarrhea. Do you remember one of your former colleagues, Michael Van Straten? Do you remember him?
I know the name, but keep going.
I think he was, he was a sort of naturopath. He used to do a phone-in on LBC on health.
Granted.
He was wonderful. I don't know if he's still with us. I once suffered from this sort of problem, and I phoned him up, and he told me something. I've never forgotten it. It was called the BRAT diet, B-R-A-T. That is bananas, apples, rice, and toast, dry toast. He said, if you just eat that, you'll soon get better. And I did just eat that, and I soon got better.
Bananas?
B-R-A-T. Bananas, rice.
Rice.
Apples and dry toast.
Oh, dry toast, yes. Or even a dry biscuit.
Yeah, and it was wonderful. It really worked. So, it's worth this chap trying.
Would you like some more good news, Barry?
Mm-hmm. Please do.
Michael Van Straten is still with us.
Oh, is he really?
Well, you tend to think that people who offer advice on things like this are going to live forever, don't you?
Yeah, he jolly well should be alive, shouldn't he?
Years ago, I phoned up for an appointment with my doctor, and the receptionist said, I'm terribly sorry, you can't see the doctor. I said, why not? She said, well, the doctor's died. And my first thought was, aha!
Oh, my goodness.
Aha! Got you now! Because you shouldn't die. You're a doctor. Oh, my first thought was gotcha.
Wow. And yet they do, don't they?
What, die?
Yeah.
Yes, they do. Of course they do.
It's outrageous, really.
Do they live longer than us doctors?
No. I mean, I knew some medical students, and it's no wonder, really.
Oh, what you're saying, yes, yes. Apparently
they live it up.
The day is gone when they were getting cocaine out of their medicine chests, and
now
she's raising her eyebrows, Kath, which means that the day has not gone when they're getting cocaine.
Well, it was some time ago that I was at university, but they were certainly still managing it then.
You do hear some stories, don't you, about medical students?
Oh, well, they saw it as an experiment. I understand the mechanics of it, they said, so it's...
The worst story I've heard about medical students, I tend not to believe, but Barry, you can either yay or nay this one, OK?
Mm.
After a night of heavy drinking, a group of medical students broke back into the teaching hospital, where there was contained inside a large jar a human head.
Oh, God.
Which they got out of the jar and proceeded to use for a game of impromptu football.
Oh, God.
I know.
It's very macabre.
Well, I was told it by a trainee nurse who was trying to make us all go green.
Again, those women have, or men...
Yes.
It's 2018. They have all the best stories, don't they? The nurses.
I may say so. I think perhaps they were feeling a little heady.
Okay.
Oh, dear.
That's poor, very poor.
Oh, thank you.
My medical student friends used to have a very interesting relationship with the cadavers. Not that interesting. But they used to send them cards and things for Christmas and decorate them.
Really?
I'm not sure that's quite appropriate when you've donated your body to medical science.
Well, I don't know. You should be, I think, very respectful of somebody who has done that.
Mm. Popping a Christmas card between their toes?
Can I just ask something, please? I'm still here.
No.
Oh, OK, then. No, where do GPs go when they need to... This is not a joke, I'm just...
Where do
GPs go when they want to see a GP?
Well, I did ask one of my first psychiatrists a similar question there, which was, what do you do if you're feeling a little bit unstable... And he said, well, I just knock on the office of the person next to me and say, can I have 10 minutes? So I guess GPs do the same.
Really?
Yes. I'm against them being called GPs. I can remember the first time I heard a woman refer to her doctor as her GP, and I thought it was snobbish.
Really?
They're doctors.
Yeah, there's no denying that.
But there's just something a little bit more upmarket, isn't there, about referring to your GP.
Your general practitioner.
Say it again like that.
General practitioner.
Could be a specialist, though, couldn't he?
It's very Beverly. Do it again.
General practitioner.
General practitioner. Barry, thank you for your call. I've got to travel. I've got to crack on because we've got a bit of a queue, for which I'm grateful. And we're also going to be rushing across to Washington shortly to speak to a doctor, but not a GP.
Not a GP,
A doctor of Russian studies. Jonathan is next, and Jonathan wants to talk on this evening's key subject, which is Russia, Salisbury and chemical agents. Jonathan.
It's a bit funny, isn't it? For the past couple of years, we've been talking about Donald Trump taking the world into a nuclear conflict. Yet, in the last few weeks, Trump, along with Kim Jong-un and Putin, are trying to create world peace, while Theresa May and Amber Rudd want the world to burn in a nuclear holocaust.
And your take on that is?
Well, my take on that is that we need to get rid of our crazy leaders. Putin is not stupid enough to have authorized this attack at this time. He's got the World Cup coming up. There was the presidential election recently. He doesn't need to do this. The only person who needed this event was Theresa May because she's such a useless leader.
Okay, well, we can come back to that. Let's do this then, bearing in mind that our hearts are with those who are unwell as a result of what happened in Salisbury. At the same time, it's quite legitimate from a journalistic point of view to speculate as what might actually have happened to bring what we believe to be the situation we have into existence. And what do you think happened, Jonathan, is the question I'm really interested in hearing you answer. What do you think actually happened?
There's a chemical facility near Salisbury, as far as I'm aware, so... it would have been easy for Theresa May and Amber Rudd to get MI5 to infect this guy and his family and this police officer in order to try and discredit Putin on the international stage, while under the cover of this Russophobia she's whipped up, go after the alternative media, trying to clamp down on foreign reporters entering the country and reporting on the civil unrest that's brewing.
Okay. Jonathan, thank you for that. A lucid and thorough case scenario painted for us right there. The British government called up Porton Down. I think Jonathan was referring to Porton Down, and said, is there somebody a bus ride away from you? Because we don't want to actually tax your transport budget. Is there anybody within a bus ride of you? You know, let's say, 10 miles at 35 pence a mile. Won't stretch things, will it? Because everybody's looking at their costs nowadays. And obviously the proximity of Porton Down to Salisbury was crucial in the decision to make a hit where a hit allegedly was made, according to Jonathan's theory.
Well, you've stumbled into his area of expertise there, and of course it sounds totally legit.
Really? I do find that stumbling around can actually produce results. Why not? To Seth, who calls the programme from Bogdale, and he wants he calls the programme from Digestion, and he wants about Bogdale.
You've got me laughing now, Todd. You remember me? I used to call you from Fort Myers in Florida on Star Trek nights.
I'm going to say yes, just to keep you going and also to keep your ego intact.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, you might remember that we had debates, arguments about Doctor Who as well. Anyway, that's by the by. Let's not talk about all this boring Russian stuff, because what matters is your own digestion. And what you said about getting the perfect store, the advice was good with the psyllium husks, but you didn't go far enough, Tommy, because the store has to float for you to have healthy bowel movements. So what you need to be doing is you need to be taking nuts. So you want your almonds, your pecans. You want your Brazil nuts, you want your walnuts, because those in the store will help it float to the surface. And it has to be a light brown, Tommy. Not a dark brown. Definitely not black. If it's black, go see your doctor. If it sinks too much, go see your doctor as well.
Well, I don't know. I find that a night on the Guinness...
Yeah, but no, that's the acid from the alcohol, Tommy, and that discolours it. So does red wine. Red wine will do that as well.
It will.
And if you want to take something that's going to kill the toxins in your body, then activated charcoal tablets will do that.
Activated?
Activated charcoal. And what that is...
Are you trying to say charcoal there?
Charcoal, yeah.
Ah, good. Try one more time. Charcoal.
Charcoal.
Close.
And that, what that is that's the burnt shells from coconuts. And whenever you go to hospital, Tommy, the first thing they do if you're poisoned is they put charcoal in you. Because that is an anti-poison. So if that guy's stomach is poisoned in any way, any toxins, take the charcoal.
I was left once by a woman, a fine young woman.
Right.
It didn't last. It only lasted about 48 hours, actually. But the reason it didn't last, partly was because I didn't expect it to or want it to, but mostly because... In the kitchen the following morning, as I was brewing a cup of tea, she said to me, "What's that?" And I said, God. "Those are from the health food store. They are charcoal biscuits."
Oh,
and
really?
She said, "Don't you take those for farting?" And she looked at me as if to say, "I will not be seen or heard with a man who might... fart." So I've got everything against charcoal biscuits, Seth. I won't have them in the house anymore, just for that reason and that reason alone. Thank you very much indeed for your call. We have to pay the rent very shortly. Shall we do that now and then we can crack on safely? We've got a number of calls. Just before we go to the break, maybe, Kath, you could remind us how we can get in touch.
Give us a ring, 0344 499 1000.
across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
You're listening to Talk Radio with Tommy Boyd and Kath Boyle this evening, and in this first hour of the programme, Russia, spies, World War III. There's something for everybody in this first hour of the programme this evening. Vladimir Ivanovich Putin is re-elected president of Russia, so no shocks or surprises to worry about with Moscow. Business as usual for the next 6 years. He's been the boss since 1999, so we're going to get the same stability, security, global safety, and especially with so many young people voting for him, how can he be anything other than a figure of hope for the future? Well, not so, as I understand it, says Leon Aron, resident scholar and director of Russian studies at the American Enterprise Institute. And according to Dr. Aron's Twitter feed, to misquote Basil Fawlty, this is exactly how World War II started. Dr. Aron joins us now from Washington. Good evening. And Dr. Aron, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is Putin... essentially winning this election under two very prominent shadows. One, of course, is the shadow of Crimea, the piece of Ukraine that he seized 4 years ago. And the other one, of course, is Sergei Skripal in your neighborhood. You know, both of those things don't have to be part of the election. You know, the election has to be held on a Sunday in March, right? There are four Sundays in March. Putin had it on the 18th of March. And it's obvious why, because that's when he had the stem-winding speech, probably the fieriest speech of his life, on the 18th of March in the Russian parliament, where he asked to admit Crimea, just recently seized and occupied, into the Russian Federation. And then Skripal. Skripal lived openly. He did not have any protection, no guards. He could have been killed at any moment. Why kill him 10 days before the election? Well, the co-chair of Putin's campaign actually felt that it helped to consolidate people. And I think it probably did give Putin some additional turnout and support. Not that he was going to lose, but you see, the economy is down. The incomes are down fourth year in a row. Russia has eked out 1.5%, which is for developing country GDP growth, is nothing. And in fact, it's looking probably to slip back into a recession. What cemented Putin in his first two terms, 2000 to 2008, is this immense growth of the economy. So where do you go? Some of his advisors suggested, you know, a reform to do something with this very toxic domestic investment climate, corruption, racketeering, bureaucratic shakedowns. Putin doesn't want to go that way because he thinks that that's the way Gorbachev went and that's his nightmare. So you need a legitimacy, you need popularity for the regime. And I think he opted for what I call patriotic mobilization. He positioned himself as a wartime president. Read his speech on March 1st, where he first scared the people by this sense of sort of war with the West, literally war. And then he said, well, but we have this nearly futuristic, some of them are almost apocalyptic weapons, so I'll protect you. So this is, you know, not a particularly good omen for the next 6 years.
Okay, two things. Crimea first. You probably weren't watching Ukrainian national television this morning, but during their weather forecasts, as part of their news programme, the map of the Ukraine failed to show Crimea for the first time, which suggests a certain acceptance, perhaps, of things as they are, is the first point I want to make. And the second one is purely a query from an expert, which you are on this matter, being a Russian citizen initially yourself, as I understand it.
Soviet citizen,
beg your pardon. When, okay. For 150 years in the United Kingdom, we referred to this part of the world as the Crimea, mm-hmm. until very recent times when we discovered that it is properly called Crimea. A small point, but an important one, in as much as you refer to it as the Crimea.
Yeah, your light brigade fought there very valiantly.
Which is it?
Well, the famous poem.
Yeah, no, which is it Crimea or the is it Crimea or the Crimea?
Oh, at that time,
yes.
I think it was the Crimea. Yeah,
but no longer. It's now Crimea.
Correct.
Okay, these things are important, of course, when it comes to understanding gradual shifts in opinion, gradual movements of understanding. So it could be that the current status of Crimea is here to stay, and we should move on.
Well, absolutely. You know, there is. I've always said that. You know, so long as Putin is in power, forget about Crimea.
Okay.
And even when he gets out of power, it's going to be a very long process. You know, China seized Tibet, what, 60 years ago? It's still there, of course, because it goes to the core of the Russian national consciousness, of the history of that part of the land, which was first Turkish and then taken by Catherine the Great from the Turks. So, no, absolutely. But that makes it even, I think, more interesting that Putin scheduled the election on the literally on the day when Crimea was admitted to the Russian Federation.
Whoa. He shifted it by a week, and that was only because of International Women's Day. Don't laugh.
Yeah.
It's a fact.
Right. International Women's Day was not on a Sunday.
It was huge in Russia, though. It was huge in Russia, bigger than anywhere else in the world.
I remember that.
Fur hats off.
Very well. Yeah, but come on. This is a hedge. This is a footnote. He could have had it on the first Sunday, the second Sunday. He decided to have it on the Sunday when Crimea was admitted to the Russian Federation.
Okay, Salisbury. As far as you're concerned, not just the Russians, but Putin himself gave the green light to what happened to the Skripals in Salisbury.
Well, killing a former spy...
Attempting to kill,
right. In a country that is the key, probably after the United States, the most important member of the NATO, the old Russian foe, from the Cold War, actually from the Civil War, Russian Civil War, with a substance. He could have been stabbed. He could have been smashed. He could have been run over by a car. With an agent, it's like with Litvinenko, which is trackable to Russia, is a statement. Now, could it have been done? The stakes are very high. I'm sure they calculated the reaction. I would think that Putin was involved, yes.
It's their style, though. They don't do too much stabbing and smashing. If you look at Litvinenko and then before him, Georgi Markov, substances.
Yes. It's neater. It's not as bloody and all of that. But again, you know, killing with something that's not only made in Russia, as in the case of Litvinenko and Skripal, would have been, you know, sort of, you know, a normal precaution if you don't want to be tracked.
It's been good talking to you, Dr. Aaron. I don't think you've persuaded us that World War III is on its way, so thank you for not frightening.
I never said so, but you stop trying to scare your listeners.
Stop trying to frighten the horses, as we say over here.
All right.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Evening, and it's no longer Putin night on this particular show with Tommy standing in for Ian Lee. Kath, I think we've not necessarily kicked that one into touch because I'm going to be Ian for the rest of the week, and I'm sure there will be developments in the Salisbury thing and the Kremlin thing. And what I would like, what I don't know, and I would very much like to know, because then we could park the whole thing, move on and come back to it when this happens, is... there can't be a trial yet because there have not been any arrests. If there is never a trial because no one is ever arrested, does that mean that we, the public, will never get to see what evidence has been garnered thus far?
Also, we've ejected 23, is it? People who were on the list of potential spies.
Yes. Now, of course, they were described as diplomats, but they were also described everywhere as people who were actually working in intelligence. Mm. So how does this work? We have people working in this country from a foreign embassy who are known to be antagonists to our system and our method of government. And we know that they are working for the intelligence services, therefore they are spies. But what, we put up with it?
Well, I think...
Or do we try and nobble them?
I think there's two things. I don't know. But I would imagine there's a case for saying better to have them inside the tent
than
out, you know, going outwards. And also the fact we're probably doing the same thing there. In fact, they've just ejected some of our, quote-unquote, diplomats. Yes.
How many?
I saw it the other day. Let me check.
Oh, I thought... They were still getting round to doing that.
Oh, I saw something. The Russian embassy, by the way, is particularly sassy on Twitter. I don't know if you've noticed. And sometimes, you know, the idea of what is a humorous situation to...
Russians are sassy.
Yes.
They're massively sassy.
It's another 23, says Sam, but let me just double check. But yeah, they're incredibly sassy.
That's a bit man-for-man marking, isn't it?
Well, didn't we swap Skripal for someone else for the...
No, that wasn't man-to-man at all.
It was man-to-woman.
We got... I don't know how many women were involved, but I can do a head count for you. 10 Russian agents who were working as what's called illegals in the United States and Canada, let's say North America, and who were arrested largely thanks to information being passed from, as it were, within the Kremlin. 10 of those were swapped for 4... spies who had been working for the West inside Russia. So that was a 10-4 makeshift, make weight. You know, it's a bit like when two footballers get traded, but there's also 50 million going one way with one of the players, but not the other. And you always think, OK, well, it's very clear then that this player, player A, is that much a better player than player B, because for them to make up a swap... 10 or 20 million quid's got to be added to one of the two players. And it's quite obvious then that if there were 4 spies who worked for the West traded against 10 spies who worked for Russia, one or all of the 4 spies who came to live in the case of one Salisbury were more important, approximately 2.5 times as important as the 10 spies who went back to live in Russia.
Wow. Well, here's the press release from this week.
Right.
17th of the 3rd. On March 17th, UK Ambassador to Russia Laurie Bristow was summoned to the Foreign Ministry, where he was handed a note stating that in response to the provocative actions of the British side and groundless accusations against the Russian Federation with regard to the incident in Salisbury, UK, on March 4th, 2018, the Russian side has taken the following decisions in response. 23 diplomatic staff of the UK Embassy in Moscow are declared persona non grata and are to be expelled from Russia within a week. Taking into account the disparity in the number of the two countries' consular missions, the Russian Federation recalls its agreement on the opening and operation of the Consulate General of the United Kingdom in St. Petersburg. Respective procedures will be followed in accordance with international legal practices. Wow. Due to the unregulated status of the British Council in the Russian Federation, its activities are terminated. The British side is warned that the court, in case of further unfriendly actions against Russia, the Russian side reserves the right to take further retaliatory measures. So they're not messing around, are they?
So how many of the Brits coming back are spies? That's something we'll never know, of course. The technical answer is none of them. They're diplomats. The Russians are spies, but our boys and girls are diplomats, correct? Do you remember the rock outside the Russian embassy? There was a fantastic, I mean literally fantastic, spy story from, I think, about 10 years ago in which... I think MI5 or MI6 built a rock that was actually a secret microphone.
Oh, my God.
Oh, they did. Look it up. Look up rock. Look up rock. Spy rock.
Russian embassy.
And they put the rock. They put the rock outside a Russian, I believe, outside a Russian embassy or a consulate.
Yeah, you're right.
Tell me.
Telegraph. Russian, this is from the Telegraph. What's the date on this? 19th of January 2012. Russian spy rock was genuine, former chief of staff admits. It was a spy plot so far-fetched it would be worthy of James Bond, a transmitter concealed inside an artificial rock by British agents and placed next to a Russian street in order to steal classified data. But it has emerged that the Spyrock diplomatic row, which damaged relations with Russia in early 2006, was not a work of fiction after all. Britain initially laughed off accusations from Moscow that spies had been caught red-handed using the fake rock to contact agents and download sensitive information. Now, 6 years on, Tony Blair's former chief of staff has admitted that the embarrassing episode was entirely true and not merely far-fetched Russian propaganda. Cheeky devils.
I've seen a picture of it, and do you know what it looks like? It looks like one of the rocks that you would see in Star Trek. You know the rocks that Kirk would pick up and hurl?
Yes.
At the lizard monster.
You can buy similar ones at garden centres and you can hide your back door key in.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, I know someone. I'm sure I can say this because you won't be able to work out who it is. I know an SAS operative who hides his back door key, you know, inside a rock, and I thought that was quite a dangerous thing to do because it's quite clearly a plastic rock.
And it's
now, if I don't appear
made,
tomorrow, you know why I've been off.
Okay. We're talking about spying. I'd love to be a spy. You, listening to this, whether you're male, female, old, young, whatever, you would love to be a spy, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you just love to be a spy? Because it's so glamorous, because it's so devious, and yet you're being devious in a way that is going to serve your great nation. And your success, your achievements will never be known. So only you will be able to look at yourself in the mirror and go, I'm a hero. No one else knows. I won't get an MBE for this or a DFS and bar or whatever you get. I am, because I am a spy. You'd like to have been a spy.
No, I wouldn't.
Oh, God, you wouldn't.
I've seen what happens to female operatives. In films, they were the first ones to get bumped off.
They do get a bad deal of it, yes. Carve her name with pride.
Exactly.
Is one of the Great War stories, of course.
Seducing big, you know, oily villains. No thanks.
I wasn't thinking about the sexual side of it.
Well, there will be, won't there?
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. My mum taught Christine Keeler, who was involved in the great spy sex scandal of the 1960s, and a very attractive woman she turned into. But my mum said, always used to say, I don't think she ever really understood at all what she was getting involved in because she just wasn't that bright, really. Let's take a couple of calls. Martin is next. He calls from the Liverpool area of Merseyside. Martin, thank you for your patience.
Oh, thank you, Tommy, for having me on. It gets more and more bizarre, doesn't it? Especially listening to you there. God. But no, you don't want to be a spy. It's not nice. They tell you to forget everything you know, and you can't talk about it to anyone. But anyway, no, the point I was going to say, Tommy, was to do with the rolling out the red carpet. Now, it seems that the red carpet's been rolled out for Saudi Arabia and the red carpet's been rolled out for the Nikri Indonesian governments, and yet both of those are involved in buying weapons from the UK. Whereas, in contrast, Russia is not a customer of the UK. So, I mean, do you think this is some sort of sour grapes over, you know, a competitor for their arms trade? Don't you think? No one seems to have mentioned anything about the Saudi Arabia thing.
Well, certain sections won't keep quiet about Saudi Arabia and arms and the use to which they're put. It isn't something that's being brushed under the carpet, red or otherwise at all. But you are talking about a metaphorical red carpet, aren't you?
Well, I did see a picture. It looked like a red carpet outside Number 10 with the Saudi, you know, king, whatever he was.
But I've never seen a red carpet outside Number 10.
It looked like it, but maybe they've edited it. It's just on a picture on the internet.
Well, they are doing a lot of photoshopping these days, aren't they? I mean, look at Jeremy Corbyn's hat.
Yeah, I know, terrible. But there she was, Theresa May, shaking hands with the Saudis. Yet at the same time, they've been proven to be bombing another country with our weapons.
Yes, it is known that the weapons are being put to use by the Saudis and that many of those weapons have been purchased from British arms firms. And as I said, that there are various political organisations and splinter groups who want to talk about nothing other than that. So it's certainly not something that's being ignored or brushed under the carpet. I have my own views about it, and it's clear to me that you do as well. But you're in a better position to state them than I, so what do you say about it, Martin?
Well, from my own experience, sorry, Tommy, I was actually in Indonesia at one time, quite a long time ago, and I got embroiled in a rather difficult trade problem, and I was actually told by the British government that I need to say nothing about this and remain completely quiet and forget all about everything I know and my marriage and my wife and everything.
Well, you can tell us because you're only on the radio, so go ahead.
Well, exactly. That's what I thought because I'm coming out with it now.
Well, do it. So what went on?
It's all at iAware now because I've got a channel as well on the internet that talks about it and discusses it because I phoned up MI5 today. Do you know what they did to me?
I'm fascinated, first of all, about how you got their number. But anyway, carry on. So what happened?
No, I talked to MI5, and guess what they did?
I don't know.
We have to disconnect this now.
Yeah.
Because they don't want me picking up any evidence or any discussion with them about what happened in Indonesia. And so I'm looking for a human rights lawyer now who will help me with the issue.
Okay.
Because I was poisoned in Indonesia, and the British government tried to cover it up.
By whom were you poisoned?
It's okay to kill a British person, but you get a foreign person in the UK who gets poisoned. Oh, God, all hell breaks out.
Who are you alleging poisoned you, and with what?
This is a problem, you see. I don't know exactly what poisoned me, but I ended up in hospital, and the embassy and the, the Foreign Commonwealth Office questioned me, and in that meeting, that final meeting I had, they told me I had to forget everything I know because, like I come back to the other point about the red carpet for Saudi Arabia and the Nickery Indonesians, they've got a trade deal into Indonesia that's worth billions of pounds and I can die, basically. That's what they said to me.
Right. What were you doing in Indonesia and for whom?
Yeah, I was a teacher at a university in Surabaya.
And who do you believe may have administered a poison and why?
Well, this is what is very, for me, it's just getting more and more bizarre because I do feel that there's, like I said at the beginning, I said there's this issue of the red carpet being rolled out for Saudi Arabia and the Nickery Indonesian government. Now, if you look closely what those governments actually are, they're both Sunni governments, right? Sunni,
yes.
Muslim governments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, both of them play into the game of buying, an enormous amount of and money involved in trade with the UK. Yet Russia does not act as a customer for the UK.
Right. One last question to you, Martin, because we've got a big queue.
Okay.
Not at all. I'm grateful for your call. It's been intriguing and colourful. But have you got MI5's number there by any chance?
Not right in front of me. No, but you've got all the information on iAware now. Just go on the internet and look at it.
Well, as I've got you, what was it, an 0207 number?
What, the number for...
MI5.
MI5.
You said you rang MI5 this morning.
Yeah.
I want to do it. I'm going to do it now. There's probably some... Yeah. Well, give me the number.
Try it.
Give me the number.
Well, for MI5?
For MI5.
Let's have a look. Is it in front of me? It must be somewhere on the internet. That's where I got it from.
Well, get it and give it to me then. Now. I want to ring them now.
Yeah, go on, give it a go. You've got a computer in front of you. I haven't. No, you ring them up and ask them about Indonesia and about a British teacher in Indonesia.
Are you sure you rang up MI5 this morning?
Sorry?
Are you sure you rang up MI5 this morning?
Yeah, absolutely.
On your mobile or on your landline?
On this same line, Tommy.
Well, what is this, a landline or a mobile?
Landline.
Well, put the phone down on us then and dial 1471.
1471?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then that will give you the last three numbers that you rang.
Oh, okay.
And unless you phoned loads of people today, one of them will be MI5's number.
Excellent.
And call back our switchboard and give them the number, and then I'll ring MI5 on air. What happens when you ring MI5, then? Does a voice just go, MI5?
No, you get through to a nice lady, and then you explain your problem, and then they say that they need to cut you off because they can't discuss what I'm talking about.
No, but I'm just interested in the process, because normally when you ring businesses now, you get... first of all, you get... All our lines are engaged, but but please stay with us because your call is very important to us. Did you get
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's true.
Did you get that? From my five, your call is very important
actually.
To us. Okay, no, so you got straight through a human being. So you didn't have to press option 1, 2, 3, or 4.
No, not that I recall.
If your call is connected with the new Cold War, press 1. If your call is connected to the Trump administration, call, press 2. You didn't get any
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
You got straight through to a human being and you said, I want to complain about the red carpet in Saudi Arabia.
No, I said I want to talk to you about the issue in Indonesia.
All right. And then you talked to, you got put through to somebody.
Yeah.
And you were with them for how long?
Oh, not long, like just 3 or 4 minutes, really.
Right.
And then she says, you know, I've got to disconnect you, I've got to end this call now.
Right.
And she got off quickly.
And you reckon that's because you were barking up the right tree about something. All right,
yeah.
Listen, thanks for your call. It's definitely been fascinating. If you do manage to come across the number of MI5 in yep. your records anywhere, Martin, do call back this evening and
no,
let me know what it is. All right,
that.
Good lad, thank you. What do you think, Kath? A little cough there, friends. Huey Green used to say that on his Opportunity Knocks. He used to have cough from time to time, and he just used to say afterwards, he used to go, a little cough there, friends.
And just to explain the noise I made.
Just to explain, yeah, he coughed, then you get a little cough there, friends.
I think Martin believes what he's saying.
Okay, fine. I think that's very, very diplomatically put. That is right there. This evening on the programme, we've been talking about Russia and the spy thing and Salisbury, of course, and chemical weapons to a certain extent. I'm intrigued by the fact that having discovered the possibility that a nerve agent was responsible for two awesome invasive injuries on a park bench in Salisbury on a Sunday afternoon, the police realising the possibility that this lethal substance was all around this park bench, put up a 999 Millet's tent over it, which kept blowing away. And this, despite the fact that they're no more than 10 minutes by road from Porton Down, where they presumably have battlefield standard erections, huge erections, that they can put over this toxic substance. And instead, you've got this little tent that kept blowing away. So we're talking about that. We're also talking about Anton Deck a little bit later on. Sadly, tragically, in the fine state of Arizona, a pedestrian has been killed, knocked over by a driverless car. Arizona is the epicentre of driverless car isms.
Oh, really?
It's the first place on earth to allow them to be used legitimately on the roads. So they're trailblazing there, and it's done them good because it's brought an awful lot of business to Arizona because the people who want to develop these cars want to prove that they work on the roads. And so Arizona's benefited enormously from that policy. However, it's now become the place where the first pedestrian fatality has occurred. So we obviously ought to talk about that a little bit later on.
Why Arizona? Long straight roads?
Good question. I think they were opportunistic about the economic impact of opening up their roads to driverless cars, and it's worked for them.
You know where they're trialling them in this country?
No.
Milton Keynes.
Are they?
Mm-hmm. That's the
plan.
Are
they out on the roads then?
They've certainly, I mean, when I used to work for BBC Three Counties, we were talking about it a lot, and I'm pretty sure, let me just check, but I know that that was definitely the place that was most interested in them. That was our Arizona.
All right. Whilst you're doing that, myself and the good listener. Good evening, good listener. How are you this evening? If I find you listening alone, then a moment in your shell-like ear, just me and you. I know it's an artificial relationship and you can't actually answer me back, but I will anticipate that your answer is something along the lines of surprisingly well, thank you, when I ask you, because I mean it, how are you? This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd. Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
So I've been sent an SMS from Steve, who's listening in Bladen. Steve, thank you for this. He says MI5's phone number is, and he gives it. So I'm tightening.
I know they advertise in newspapers for,
yeah, they do.
For
be a spy.
Jobs, don't they?
I did what turned out to be 3 weeks of work for the CIA way back in Ethiopia. I was hired to do some filming for a charity that was going upcountry in Ethiopia to dig a well in a village that had no water. And so they were suffering in one of the less awful famines, but a famine nevertheless, that Ethiopia has experienced, that we know about over the last 20 or 30 years. And so we got up there, and I was surprised by the person who was running the whole thing from the point of view of the, in inverted commas, charity. Because he wasn't what you expect from a charity worker at all. He was 6'2", military bearing, military haircut, extremely well organised, and didn't seem to give a hoot about the poor people who were starving and dying of dehydration. He seemed to have other things on his mind. So we went further and further north towards where a battle was raging between the Ethiopian government and some rebels. And it was known that there was a possibility that the rebels were being resourced by the Soviet Union. And it was also suspected that the Ethiopian government were being resourced by the United States of America. But nobody was ever supposed to see any of the technology that they brought in to further their two respective sides in this. And we carried on going north and north and north. And he kept saying, we'll be at the village soon. We'll get to the village. We won't be long now. Now we can start to hear guns. Boom, 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 boom. Boom, 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 boom. So we pulled in and we said, this is the village. And we were there then for 2 or 3 weeks. And he kept disappearing with a pair of binoculars and going and having a look at things. Anyway, the guns were getting louder and louder. Boom, 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 boom. And now we knew that we were almost within range of some artillery. So he radioed for a plane to get us out of there. But the plane said, we can't get in, not underneath all this artillery. So he said, OK, meet us at such and such a location. So we drove 40 miles south and we found ourselves turning into a makeshift airfield in which a runway had been constructed using 20 American gunship helicopters. They were USAF. They didn't have insignia, but they were American. And everybody running around in the base was American. And they weren't supposed to be there. Because America's not supposed to actually get involved in other people's wars. And I always remember this guy, who I'm 99% certain now was pure CIA. He said to us, the little film crew that I was with, as we swung into this makeshift airfield, he said, the plane will be landing in about 10 minutes, he said. Don't anybody take any photographs or you will be shot. And it was fantastic. I was so excited. I'm doing a bit of mild spying here. I'm involved in something Indiana Jones-like. And you know the best bit of it? When the plane landed, it wasn't allowed to stop. It had to keep taxiing on the grass. And so we had to run alongside it, throw our kit bags into the open door, and then jump onto a moving plane, which then took off underneath the artillery.
Oh, my.
Fantastic! Loved every minute of it. Always wanted to be a spy. Closest I've ever got. What are we going to do next? We've got a number for the for MI5 in the United Kingdom. Are we going to ring them just to see what it sounds like?
What I was more intrigued by was Martin said that he had a recording of his conversation with them.
Excellent.
Now, as soon as we get hold of that, he's there, isn't he?
All right. If anybody else is waiting to get to air and I can see a few lights flashing, just bear with us. We'll tidy up with Martin first. Martin has the audio of his earlier phone call with MI5. Martin, off you go.
Yeah, hello, Tommy. Thank you. Thank you very much. I found the information.
Need to give that out, but we've got it written down.
The phone number.
Yeah, we can have it, but we don't need to give it out to all and sundry, do we?
Well, it's a public number.
Okay, well.
Is even so. MI5.
Wait a minute, I'm confused. 0800. MI5 is on an 0800 line.
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean they're charging 34p a minute or something?
I hope not.
Go on, anyway. You've got the audio of your call, have you?
Well, basically, I've audioed it, I've recorded it onto audio this morning.
Right.
Speaking to MI5, and just since speaking to you, Tommy, sorry, what I'm doing is copying it to my computer, so you'll have to give me a minute.
Okay. Should we speak to someone else in the meantime?
Yeah, we'll talk to Dave whilst we're waiting for you, Martin. Let our people know when you've got the audio up and running and we'll come back to you. Dave's on the line from Hove, also wants to talk about Russia. Hello, Dave.
Heidi-ho.
Heidi, hi.
Firstly, I don't believe it was Russia. That there's nothing to gain from it, and you covered it with the silly little tents and that. I mean, that's not chemical warfare, that's biological warfare. And he's huge. My evidence, there was a young lady killed in Syria recently from Lewis. Did you read about her?
Yes.
Excellent. She was fighting with this all-female guerrilla group with the Kurds, but they weren't fighting the Russians. They weren't fighting ISIS. They were fighting the Turkish forces.
Correct.
And that, in my humble opinion, is where the biggest threat is. Mr. Putin is all that is keeping President Erdogan and his caliphate ambitions out of Europe, because he's got a bigger army.
Okay, I'm going to have to work my way slowly through your hypothesis here, Dave. Because the tragic young lady from Lewis was killed fighting what in that instance turned out to be Turkish forces in Syria.
Yep.
Got that bit. Just go walk me through slowly your connection with that and Putin and Salisbury, if that's what you have.
President Putin,
yes,
has always backed President Assad and the Syrians. Yes?
In recent times, yes.
Yeah. Pretty much President Assad and the Syrian army, that was all that was keeping what was then the Muslim Brotherhood out of Israel. He stood in the way.
Keep going.
Now, if this young lady from Lewis is fighting Turkey or Turkish forces, why are the Russians the baddies? It just goes to show that the Russians are fighting the same enemy as us, or at least defending the Syrians from the same enemy. I have nothing against the Turkish people, they're smashing people, but I'm afraid their hierarchy is a little bit dodgy.
Well, better men and women than me have failed to fully explain where allegiances should rightly, or indeed are, rightly or wrongly, being deployed as far as the Syrian question goes. It's just difficult, very difficult, to work out who your best friend ought to be in that awful, awful human tragedy. Dave, thank you for your call.
No worries, mate.
Much appreciated. Toodle pip. Archie has SMS'd on Salisbury. How come the doctor who treated the Russians is not ill? Again, that's something that conspiracy theorists will march on with, won't they?
But surely they'll be protective. They'll be wearing protective gear.
I think what Archie's referring to is the fact that one of the first people on the scene was a doctor who was a passerby.
Oh, really?
Yes. Hmm. Doesn't say whether they're a GP or not, but they're a doctor. And helped clear the airways of the two victims, but to the best of our knowledge, was not affected by whatever the toxins were.
Well.
Whereas a police officer has been seriously affected by those toxins. The story is now that he may have gone to the house.
Right.
Belonging to Skripal, Sergei Skripal, and where Yulia had been. And theories about how the toxin might have been administered include they may have been impregnated on her clothing.
Mm-hmm. There was a woman with a mask spotted, wasn't there?
No, have we seen a woman
yes,
with a mask?
A woman with a black surgical mask. Because if you are an evil agent, you'd be wearing a black... I mean, walking around the street with a black surgical mask on.
But it would be black, wouldn't it? Because remember, in The Lone Ranger...
Okay, exactly.
The black mask meant, okay.
Yeah.
The possibility that it was given to her as a gift, which had been wrapped, to be given to her father when she landed. So that the toxin was effectively deployed in Moscow or wherever she travelled from. And the possibility that it was also administered via the ventilation system of his BMW. So do you know where the air intake is on a BMW?
No idea.
It's at the bottom of the windshield on the front. You know you've got those little grills on the front?
All right.
Yeah, that's your ventilation air intake. So that would have been quite an easy way, just to sprinkle a little bit of this substance, having mixed it with the activating agent.
We're never going to know, though, are we?
That's why it is just meat and drink to the conspiracy community, because, no, we're never going to know.
But
I suspect
to that community, even if we were given answers, they wouldn't believe them.
Well,
because the information came too easily.
Only one conspiracy theory has ever been proved beyond any doubt to be absolutely correct, and that is Watergate. I remember having an argument with somebody who said that every single conspiracy theory was just a piece of fiction, and I said that Watergate began as a conspiracy theory and turned out to be so true that the president had to leave the White House. But he came up with that that ever-present argument that some people use when they run out of argument, which is, that's completely different.
Yeah.
Let's talk to another Dave. This is Dave in Bridge North, Shropshire. Dave, good evening. Thank you for calling.
Oh, good evening, Tommy. You're absolutely welcome. I was absolutely gripped by your where is the ventilation on a BMW chat, so I thought I'd give you a call promptly.
You have indeed been pretty prompt.
Yes. Now, I must admit, I haven't been listening to the show for too long because I've just returned from the pub, so you'll have to excuse me for my ignorance. But I was hoping to that I could give you a call about something a little random. Is that okay?
Okay, try us.
Well, I'm a man of a certain age, kind of mid-40s. So I know you from kind of Wackaday, I think.
Okay.
And I went to a grammar school in kind of the mid-80s was when I first started going there. And I hated it. It was a really strict old school kind of grammar school with you had to have a briefcase and you sat at a wooden desk and there were no computers and it was all very strict and somber and dowdy. And it kind of almost broke me, but there was a lad in my class that kind of had a way of lifting the spirits. He was kind of the naughty lad, but he, in his misbehaviour, it kind of gave you the strength to kind of fight back against all this dour teachers that were kind of trying to break you and crush your spirits. Kind of a bit like the Cool Hand Luke kind of a scenario. Do you ever have that kind of a scenario in your life, Tommy, where someone of they just inspire you and you don't know where they get it from? This was a lad who was only my age, 11 or 12, but he just stood up to it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think so, yes.
Well, this lad, right, he was a wrong un from the first day. The teachers took a dislike to him and they must have had, like, meetings in the staff room about him, you know, about his behaviour. Hang on a sec, just got to turn the bath water off. So as soon as a maths teacher took a particular dislike to him, and as soon as he walked in, he'd make him stand up on his chair, this lad, and he'd have to hold a briefcase in each arm, arms out, stretched out by his sides, and hold a briefcase for, like, as long as he could. And that's really hard, you know. After a little while, your arms start shaking and it gets heavier and heavier, and he'd kind of drop it down, and then he'd come round and he'd pull him by his sideboards and, like, you get that back up. And he'd give him a real, real hard time and just kind of make him feel bad. So, and he made him sit right at the front, in front of his desk, moved his desk right to the front, this lad. So the teacher's desk was right there. And what he did, he'd have a habit of sitting, marking homework, this teacher, and he'd put his feet right on this lad's desk with the soles of his feet right in the lad's face. you know, proper degrading, mean-spirited stuff. And we were all sat there the first time he did this. We were like, can you believe the teacher's doing that silently? You know, we couldn't talk to each other, but we were all looking, like, shaking our heads. And then this lad, John, what he did, he got his little bottle of Tipex out with a little brush. And, he was right at the front of the class so everyone could see. And he wrote twat on the bottom of the teacher's sole of his shoe in Tipex. Okay. And everyone could see, and it was just like, go on, John, do it for us. and it was just like, just imagining that teacher getting home that night and taking off his shoes.
Yes.
And just seeing that on the bottom and trying to figure out when it happened and thinking, that
nice story.
Little bugger.
Nice little story. Now, nice little story. Now, watch your language. because I just have to apologise to anybody living approximately north of, I would say, Manchester, who could conceivably be more offended by the word that was painted on the shoe than people living south of Manchester, then I apologise for that. And it's not the way in which the caller intended the word to be understood at all. So forgive him. It's a geographical thing, and I'm very aware of it because I've fallen foul of it myself, as indeed has David Cameron, who used the word on an interview on a commercial radio station in London some 10 or 15 years ago when somebody's mobile phone went off. And he didn't know that it is not, in all parts of Britain, another way of saying twit. OK, so I say that. I think I've got that one covered, have I?
Yeah.
And he's gone now. It's a shame because I wanted to ask him whether he always has a bath after he's been to the pub. Because most of us have a bath before we go to the pub, don't we?
Yeah. Maybe he's just especially clean.
Maybe it's just especially hygienic, yes. Mm. What we'll do is take a breath pause and then we'll come rushing back. And when we're back in business, we need to talk a little bit about these driverless cars, which tragically have just claimed their first fatality in Arizona in the United States. Kathy's here. I'm Tommy Boyd. I'm in for Ian Lee and this is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd. Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
The skeletal structure of this evening's show has been very much Salisbury, the Politburo, the Kremlin, Putin, MI5, and the possibility, I suppose, of World War III, which is extremely unlikely. In fact, forget it. Because there's so much there and so much to talk about and so much nutrition for the community of conspiracy theorists who are no doubt working on websites dedicated to it right now. Are there any dedicated websites out there to the Salisbury Conspiracy, I think it will end up being called?
I bet there are.
The Salisbury Conspiracy of 2018.
The main one is called Twitter.
Ah, yes.
I've seen people think telling the ether that it's all a conspiracy to try and distract attention from Telford.
Telford?
Mm-hmm.
From Telford?
The sexual abuse of young women by, Asian men in Telford.
So Brexit? I've heard that it's designed to stop people worrying about Brexit, stop focusing on the fact that the Brexit negotiations are a shambles.
Yep.
And there's another theory suggesting that Theresa May is using it in order to get rid of Boris Johnson because it's one for the foreign secretary. And according to them, it just proves how all at sea he is when it comes to talking about things diplomatic. And in all of this, what's been missed is that Michael Gove is threatening a ban on shock collars for dogs. And this has got a man called Quinton Letts. Very aerated indeed. Do we know who Quinton Letts is?
Yes, he's a columnist.
He is. He's a very lively little columnist, and he writes very rudely about all sorts of people. I read a piece he wrote about Richard Branson, and it was hilariously unpleasant. But he's up in arms about it, and what he said, because he was being interviewed on something like Politics Today at lunchtime, and what he said is that if another of his dogs gets killed because he can't put a shock collar on it, then he will take the corpse of his dog and dump it on Michael Gove's desk.
Wait, another of his dogs?
Another of it. One of his dogs, he believed, he believes, died, as I understand it, because he was unable to properly operate the shock collar as he intended it on the dog. Now, I've only had just recently found out what shock collars are because I've looked them up, and they are remote control devices that go round the dog's neck, usually, but not always, and they've got two little prongs that remind me of taser contacts that touch the dog's skin on the inside of the collar. And then you get your remote control device on which you, I believe, can choose the size of the shock that you give the dog. OK? So if, for example, your problem is that your dog yaps whenever anybody comes up the front garden path and you don't want it to, every time it yaps, you can give it a bzzz. And it goes, and apparently the dog learns not to bark, otherwise it will get an electric shock.
Right, I've never had a dog, but I've known people that do, and normally they just yell at it when it starts and tell it to shut up, and it tends to work.
There are definitely other training methods available.
Yeah.
But I think the shock collar treatment is for desperate people whose dogs just simply don't seem to be responding to any kind of training, or lazy people. Now, I don't know whether Quinton Letts is desperate and or lazy. Obviously, a bit of both, or to a degree or another.
You can't be desperate, because surely that's a once-in-a-dog-time purchase, isn't it? But if he's planning to buy another one for the next dog, it suggests that that's his MO.
First of all, he strikes me as being somebody who doesn't know anything about training animals. And training animals is a very particular thing. You know, as a former dolphin trainer and ashamed of it, and former horse trainer and proud of it, there are various things that you can do with animals to persuade them to do unnatural things.
Mm. Isn't it about treats?
Yes, entirely. Thank you. That's all it is.
It's same as children.
Rewards. Exactly. There are no sticks. Although I did see a dolphin once being tapped on the nose by a Belgian dolphin trainer because that dolphin was stealing the food of another dolphin in the pen.
Mm.
And he wanted to make it absolutely clear that that was a no-no, which it wasn't cruelty, but it wasn't a carrot either.
No, and it wasn't natural. Surely the other dolphin should stick up for itself.
No, they're not as intelligent as people like to think.
Oh, really?
I'm afraid not, no. Just nowhere near, actually. They're very trusting, which is their problem. And also, they have been given by God what appears to be a smile on their face. So no matter how heinous the conditions, how unpleasant is their labour, I don't think they do dolphin shows anymore, do they?
Anyway, yes, they do.
In some countries they mm-hmm. Do they really?
Mm-hmm.
But not surely in what we like to call civilised countries.
They do.
Oh, God, where?
I know for sure that they do them in this country.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it should be stopped. It's not good enough. The dolphin show that I did was a real eye-opener because we had six dolphins in the pool and we led the audience to believe that each of the dolphins did different tricks, but it was only one dolphin in the pool that was trained. The other dolphins just went round and round and round.
Right.
And so what you would do is you would say, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the dolphin, Poppy, is going to jump through the hoops for you. And so Baby would jump through the hoops, you see. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Prinny is going to jump over a big stick for us. And Baby would jump over the stick. So that was the first ludicrous, appalling deception. But the other thing was that the dolphins didn't last very long because the conditions in the tank were so unacceptable.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Too confined, or...?
Well, first of all, no daylight. It was an it was an enclosed auditorium.
Right.
Secondly, and I think this was the worst part of it, the owners of the dolphinarium wanted the pool to appear hygienic at all times, and there was a tendency for algae to collect at the surface of the water around the pool. So every so often they would get the handyman to tip an entire drum of chlorine into
the pool. Oh, no.
To clean the mould off the sides. And then you would go in the morning and you would, with a rake, you would have to pull this translucent substance. It was a little bit like cling film. Big lumps of it out from the pool, and that was dolphin skin that had been seared off by the chlorine in the night.
My God, Tommy.
That's what I was told. So I got involved with Greenpeace and we started to, you know, try to bring about an end to these places. But that's a very long-winded way of saying that you can train animals to do all sorts of things. You just have to be patient and loving.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need an electric shock collar, Quinton Letts. Wouldn't mind having the argument with him if we can arrange to talk to him perhaps tomorrow or the night after.
I wonder. It'd be interesting. Sometimes you approach these people and they don't like to discuss their writings.
Oh, Quinton Letts would be delighted to discuss anything at any time, I would imagine.
Let's give him a try.
Well, because I think Quinton Letts, like myself, is somebody who believes that he can beat and berate absolutely anybody in any argument, doesn't need to even believe whatever it is that he's saying.
It's an exercise, is it?
Absolutely. I, of course, am driven only by the motive of integrity, as you well know. Quick word with Martin to see whether he's managed. Martin is a caller who had a conversation with MI5 earlier today, and in order to prove it, he's been trying to retrieve the audio so that we can get a sample. Hello, Martin. Any luck?
Hello, Tommy. Yeah, I've got it, but my battery's running low. But I was just saying, you know, in Indonesia, they call it Lumba Lumba, and they have a dolphin show that travels around Indonesia.
Yeah, I know. Inflatable dolphinariums.
Let's hear that audio quick before your battery dies.
Mm.
Okay. Let's just have a look.
Give us a sample.
Phone in MI5.
0800-111.
About death threats to British citizens.
45.
Can you hear it?
Yep.
OK, so that's the free phone number for suspected threats to national security.
That's right, 0800-111-4645.
Contact details for MI5 can be found on our website at www.
And this is what it's like when you phone them up.
OK.
Yeah, this is the hotline for terrorism or espionage.
Yeah, I couldn't understand it, though, what she said to me.
All right, listen, Martin, I'm coming up against a very rigid out time for the news, so I'm going to have to leave you in abeyance right now. We'll get the news.
Or you can charge your phone.
And you can recharge your phone.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd. Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Looking after the Ian Lee Show, Ian will be back next week. He's taking well-earned time off in Darkest Wales. Kathy's here this evening talking about Salisbury and Russia and all of that jazz, but also talking about Ant and Dec, Cirque du Soleil, where a tragedy happened in the United States. Although I will just take a detour for a moment and say that I've never met anybody in this country who thought anything at all of Cirque du Soleil. Although Jamie's co-presenter this afternoon was saying how wonderful she thought it was.
And Ian was very taken with it when he went to see the Beatles thing they did, Love.
Okay.
He said it was amazing.
Yeah.
As a spectacular, you know.
I just always found there's something sort of childlike about Cirque du Soleil that I try not to be... Or maybe it's because I don't find French people funny. And it's French, isn't it? They're mostly French.
I think
French.
Originally, yeah.
There's something very French about it all, even if they're not French, even if they're from, you know, Milton Keynes.
It kind of does remind me a lot of, you know, those opening ceremonies of the Olympics.
Exactly right, exactly right. Well said. It is 3 hours of an opening ceremony of nothing.
Yeah.
Martin's on the line. If you've been listening through the programme, you'll know that Martin called us earlier when we were talking about dark forces at work in the modern world, because Martin had been on the phone only this morning to MI5 trying to alert them.
Yeah.
And he recorded the conversation with MI5, and we just want to hear what MI5 sound like. So, Martin?
Yeah. OK, hello, Tommy.
Let it roll.
OK. Oh, hello, madam. Sorry to bother you. No, I found your information because... I was contacted a number of organisations, so I also contacted the Chief of Police on Merseyside. Is there anybody there that I could speak to at MI5 that might be able to help me at all?
Yeah, you come through to the right line. Is it intelligence information you're reporting this afternoon?
It's a bit of a difficult subject to talk to be honest. So I was hoping that I could speak to somebody who might be able to understand my problem, sorry.
Okay, if you're not happy to talk to me this afternoon, I can give you an email address so you can send...
No, I'm happy to talk to you. I don't want to speak to the switchboard, though.
You're not speaking to the switchboard, it's fine.
Oh, sorry, what's your name, sorry?
My name's Gabby. How can I...
Gabby?
Gabby, how can I help you this afternoon?
It's a bit difficult to talk about Gabby because it's really hard for me. So I have spoken to the police before about it and also written to the chief of police, like I said. But the problem is I've got a petition in Parliament, Gabby.
Yes.
Now, I'm afraid I feel a threat to my life because of this petition in Parliament. Sorry?
So you feel a threat to your life?
Yes, and I've been told before.
Who have you been told by?
The Foreign and Commonwealth Office.
Okay, they made a threat to your life?
Yes.
Okay, when was this?
In November 2011.
Okay, what's your name, sir? Do you mind me asking?
Yeah, I'll tell you as well. It's with George Howarth MP. You can contact George Howarth. There's a petition going into Parliament about it.
Okay.
But relating to that petition is a difficult situation for me because I was told to return to the UK and not say anything about it at all.
Okay, return from where, sir?
I was a teacher abroad, thanks. In Indonesia. But the thing why I want to speak to MI5 is because I feel like I've reported it to the police already and I don't feel like I've had much support.
Okay, sir.
So I've made a petition to the EU government.
Okay, so what I'd recommend is that it sounds as if your call isn't relating to an immediate intelligence threat. So
no, no.
I can't really handle it on this line, but I can give you an email address where you can put all of this in writing and we can pass it on to the relevant department.
Well hopefully. Sorry, Gabby, because I say when I came first into the UK, I went straight to the police station and I told them what had happened and then I got no help at all whatsoever.
Okay, sir.
So, hopefully, but what it is, this petition is to do with the war going on in Indonesia.
Okay.
And I asked for help when I first got back. And so what I've had to do is contact the ICC and also the United Nations are helping me. But in terms of the UK police, I don't feel like I'm getting any help at all, which is weird, isn't it, Gabby?
Yes, sir, I'm really sorry, but this line is for intelligence information about UK threats. I know that your matter is a concern to you, and I do apologise that you've been turned away by other authorities, but unfortunately I'm going to have to say the same thing to you, sir, but if you do feel as if we can help you, I would recommend that you do send us an email, and we will pass it on to the relevant departments for you.
Okay,
you may not hear back, but all we can do is try and pass it to the relevant people for you.
Okay, thanks, Gabby. Who's the best people to speak to? Because I wrote to the Chief of Police on Merseyside as well.
Concerning your matter, I'd recommend the Home Office, but yeah.
Home Office?
I'm not too sure how much we can do for you here.
Well, the thing is, Gabby, the point is, my MP wrote to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office.
Okay.
And they lied in the letter. And that's why I've got a petition in Parliament, because it's a cover-up.
Okay, sir, I'm sorry that that's happened, but unfortunately I'm not too sure what we can do for you.
Okay, well I think I was contacting the police because I felt like I'd been abused by the UK government. So isn't there anybody who can help with that?
Not on this line, sir, I'm afraid. We don't deal with that sort of matter.
Oh, God. So, okay, well, Gabby, just try and think about the best people you think might be to write to, because I've already contacted the European Union Parliament and I've put in a complaint to them. I've contacted the ICC and and the United Nations are helping me with an inquiry. But anything from the UK side of it seems to be a massive cover-up all the time.
Okay, sir, I am sorry, but
can't seem to get any help with it at all. But anyway, sorry, Gabby, I won't go on. But the thing is there any department to deal with foreign matters like that?
not that I would know of. So I do recommend you put all of this in writing and we can send it on.
Okay.
But right now there's nobody I can pass you through to, I'm afraid.
Okay, sorry, Gabby. So what's the email, sorry, you were going to say you think best to write to?
The email?
Yeah.
No problem. If you go on our website...
Can you just tell me what it is? Because I've got impaired vision.
Yep, no problem. Bear with me for 2 seconds.
Okay. The difficulty, Gabby, is finding the right organisation to help. You know what I mean?
Okay, so bear with me.
If you haven't got it handy, then don't worry. I'll just... have you got anybody else I could phone, you think? Hello?
Hello, sir. I can give you our website address, and that will, you'll find a contact form there.
Oh, OK. Go on, then, if you haven't got it handy.
So it's www.mi5...
MI5, yeah.
.gov.uk.
Also, Gabby, you know, my wife's still missing, right? Is there any other organisation within MI5 that helps people look for missing people?
No, sir, I am really sorry. I don't think that this is the right organisation for you to be calling this afternoon.
No. So if people go missing, who are you supposed to...
That, to me, sounds like a matter for the police.
OK. I've already been to the police...
I'm sorry, sir. I'm sure if they could help you, they would.
Okay. So have you got any other organisations you think that might be helpful?
No, sir.
So what does MI5 do then? Because I thought you were supposed to help people.
This line is very busy and it is for intelligence information only, and I have repeated myself. I don't think we can help you this afternoon, so I am going to terminate your call. I do apologise.
Okay. Thanks, Gabby.
Hello, Martin.
Yeah.
Sorry,
but he terminated me call.
I was going to say, sorry if I sounded a bit like Paul there in ever-decreasing circles. Hello, Martin.
Yeah, it's okay.
Hello, Martin.
Yeah.
Martin?
Yeah.
Who do you think MI5 is, then?
Well, when I was at the Foreign Commonwealth Office in Singapore, they told me that I'd get help from specialist services if I go to the UK, if I agreed to go to the UK.
Yes, but who do you think MI5 is? Because you asked Gabby, who was brilliant, I thought. And
sorry?
Very, I thought Gabby was very brilliant with you, if I may venture.
Yeah, no, it's
very, very patient and tried very hard to point you in the right direction. And then it turned out that it seemed to me from your question that you're not quite sure who MI5 are and what they do.
Well, it did confuse me now after being on the phone today, because I did feel that if you've had a death threat from somebody, then it is intelligence that are going to look into it, aren't they?
What is MI5, Martin?
The police. Intelligence, I presume.
You think that MI5... Right, well, do you know what MI stands for?
Intelligence?
Main intelligence.
Possibly. I don't know exactly, to be honest.
No.
What's it for, then? Sorry.
Well, MI stands for military intelligence.
OK.
There are 13 branches. The two that are most widely known are MI5 and MI6.
Oh, yeah.
MI5 looks after intelligence issues within the United Kingdom.
OK.
It protects us. MI6 is more likely to be involved in intelligence matters that are of benefit to the United Kingdom, but are happening around the world, outside our borders. So to put it crudely, MI5 is intelligence defence, and MI6 is intelligence, I'm not going to say attack, but... positive. OK?
Yeah.
Now, in the light of that, can you see that MI5 were not the people for you to bring your concerns to?
I don't think it's necessarily to do with the military. I agree with you on that.
I'm sorry?
I think maybe it's not to do with the military, from what you say.
MI stands for Military Intelligence.
OK, I see what you mean.
What do I mean?
Well, if you've been living in Indonesia for 10 years, Tommy, who do you think you're going to phone?
About what?
Well, if somebody goes missing and then you're put in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and told not to talk about your missing wife,
right?
Who are you going to contact, if not the FCO?
Well, the first thing to do would be to contact the police within the country where you believe that the person might have gone missing, which in this case presumably is Indonesia.
Yeah, we did that.
Who's we?
And the police told us that they've spoken to the Foreign Commonwealth Office, and the Foreign Commonwealth Office confirmed that they had to keep silent about the matter because it was going to cause problems because it was involving Muslims. And the British government didn't want to expose the fact that there's terrorism in Indonesia by the Muslims against British citizens.
Mm.
So they didn't want to expose that information.
OK, hang on a sec. In answer to your question, who you should have contacted, the police...
It's a bit difficult when you're in trauma as well, don't forget, Tommy, at the time.
Well, you're not in trauma now, or are you?
I'm in post-traumatic stress because I'm still looking for my wife, who's still missing.
Right. So what happened there? You went to Indonesia with your wife?
No, I didn't go with my wife. I was a lecturer in Surabaya University.
I see. So you met your wife in Indonesia?
Yeah.
And you married an Indonesian woman?
Yeah, I was there for 10 years.
OK, and during that time you married an Indonesian woman, and then what happened?
Yeah, I was happy. I was happy, you know. I was working at university,
yes,
teaching.
But her going missing, what were the circumstances of that?
Oh, well, there was an attempted murder on me, and also my wife told me that she'd been attacked and raped. And then we went to the police, and they did nothing. And then she was then abducted, and we couldn't find her at all. So I went back to the police and reported it, and then the FCO got involved and said, no, you've got to keep it quiet because it's Muslims against white people.
One bit at a time, Martin.
Mm.
Just quickly, all right?
Sorry, go on.
As Gabby said, we're all sorry to hear that you have had a difficult time and that you may still be carrying some of the emotional impact of that.
I'm not still carrying it. I'm involved in it still.
OK, well, whatever you said then. Sorry to hear that, whatever it is. However you want to put it.
Go on then.
OK. I suppose the most important thing that we should focus on...
Now
for you...
Yeah,
is
sorry,
that,
yeah.
Yeah. Is that I think, thinking through everything that's happened and everything that we've heard... I think, Martin, and I hope you won't take this badly.
I probably will.
Why is that?
Because if you're going to say something like, forget about me wife, that's what the FCO said.
Well, I'm not. I'm not going to say that at all. But again, I hope you won't be in any way feeling anything other than that somebody has tried to help. When I say that, I think... I don't know you, but I'm going to say as a friend.
Okay.
I think you ought to make an appointment to see your GP and to talk about how all these things are affecting you. Would you consider doing that?
Yes, I totally agree with you, Tommy. It has affected me terribly. I'm still upset about it.
Yeah. So, I'm going to leave you... I'm going to let you go and ask you to call us.
Yeah, I will.
Either tomorrow night or Wednesday night or Thursday night, just to let us know that you've managed to make an appointment. It probably won't be until August, the way things are with GP surgeries these days. But I think it's a good place to start. Okay.
No, thank you, Tommy.
All right, mate.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
What do you think?
I think that was the right call.
Oh, OK. Yeah, I agree. Okie doke. So where are we? Oh, well, welcome. Well, I think you said welcome back, dear listener. You know what I mean by that, I think. So that was Martin, anyway, and hopefully we've managed to help him solve what might be a key part of his problem that is solvable. Not sure about the other stuff and the wife and murder threats and got a petition in with, did he say the United Nations and so forth?
Oh, you said it was his MP was bringing it up in Parliament.
No, Parliament. OK, all of that. But I think sometimes it's a good idea to go and have a chat with your GP about how you're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? You're tuned to Talk Radio. It's 20 past 12.
The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Kath and I, whilst we were listening to those important messages, found ourselves discussing people who we like enormously and respect enormously, but they're getting up our nose a little bit. And for some reason, that's happening between me and Joanna Lumley.
Yeah, what is that?
I have no idea. I think she's a magnificent person with a huge heart and a great spirit and a willingness to, a desire to make the world a better place. And she's funny. She's really witty and beautiful. I know that shouldn't matter.
You know, she's the voice of doom.
What do you mean?
Well, this is what I've heard, that if the end were to come, if World War III were to beckon...
Yeah.
Everyone will get a phone call telling them that they've got a certain amount of time to live. Again, I don't really believe that. What's the point in telling everyone? But apparently it's going to be lovely, Joanna Lumley, darling.
You see, I tried to invent an alarm clock just for men about 40 years ago. And instead of going first thing in the morning or giving you Tony Blackburn halfway through a bunch of waffle, it would just be this, right? It would be Joanna Lumley, it would go... Just like that, just in your ear. And then a bit louder, it would go, oh, come on, wake up, darling. Just like that.
I'm sure she would do it for the right price.
Oh, it would be brilliant to wake up like that because alarm clocks are so unsoothing, aren't they? And phones.
Even though I've selected what may be the most soothing of the alarm tones offered.
What have you got?
Oh, it's like a sort of plinky plonky chimey type thing. But it's still,
like
it's a horrible way to wake up. Yeah.
Yes.
I don't like waking up. I like being asleep.
Well, you don't like being asleep.
I do.
I'm going to take you up on this one and I'm going to argue this through so that you understand. But you do not like being asleep.
Go on then.
You like going to sleep and drifting off and you like waking up, coming out of it and going, oh, just another couple of minutes.
I never get that.
But the business of being asleep, you're oblivious.
Yeah, I like oblivion.
You're as aware of what's going on in the world and in your life as you were when, for example, dinosaurs ruled the earth. You don't remember that.
Well,
you're
hang on a second.
Oblivious.
Don't you believe in lucid dreaming?
No.
Oh.
It's absurd. There's no such thing.
It's a thing.
It is not.
It's a thing. I've done it.
Sentient dreaming? No.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist.
No, it does.
No,
wonderful.
That's...
When you think, this is too ridiculous.
No, mate, that's inebriation.
Oh, I can't do that during the week, so it must be lucid dreaming.
What happens in your lucid dreams then?
Well, I'll realise halfway through that it's not my dad I'm talking to, it's actually George Clooney.
Okay.
And then you can manipulate things to your advantage.
Because
you know there are no consequences.
But you like that? Do you like the strange experience of realising that you have momentarily mistaken George Clooney for being your dad?
Yeah.
Do you not find that a little bit destabilising?
Yeah, and it's quite Freudian. It's probably not that exact scenario.
Of course it's
a bad
Freudian.
Example. But
all dreams are sexual. This has been proven by the guru, Sigmund Freud. Simple proof. It's not technical. It's not difficult to prove that all dreams are sexual.
Mm.
Every single dream.
What about the ones where you dream?
It's an expression of sexual desire.
Maybe. What about the ones where you dream you've gone to the loo?
Sex.
Come on.
It is. It would be. I've never done it. I've never dreamt.
Oh, I have a friend. It's usually men who dream that they've managed to get themselves up and go to the toilet and then they'll wake up and they're like weeing in the wash basket and stuff.
Yes, I have. I've seen that.
Yeah. It's usually drink, isn't it?
Yes. Drink is usually involved. Mm. But Freud was able to move on from the question of are all dreams sexual? Or not, sure and certain in the knowledge that all dreams are sexual because of a very simple fact, which is that in the male, all rapid eye movement sleep is accompanied by sexual arousal.
Right.
So it may be that you're not necessarily dreaming about Kylie Minogue or whatever, or indeed George Clooney, because I'm sure some men get the hots for him, of course.
Well, I'm sure.
I'm sure, certain of it. But whatever you're dreaming about, even, I'm going to say this because this is, of course, at the heart of Freud, even if it's your dad, it's a sexual dream.
Oh, my God.
So there you are.
Oof. Right, OK, I've gone right off sleep.
I didn't mean for that to happen. Didn't mean for that to happen at all.
Oh, God.
Where's our man next door? We haven't heard from him this evening. Sam, is it?
Mm. Now, he's got a very interesting relationship with his father. They hide from each other.
Not all the time.
Well, you don't know. He might be doing the long con.
Well, this is the thing, because...
Because he's due one, isn't he?
Yeah, but because you and Ian have been chatting about it recently, I'm in a state of... Well, looking for him all the time at the minute, so now would not be a good time for him to do it.
Tell Tommy the one he did in the car.
So, when I went to college, it was a good half hour's drive away. He had got someone to lock him in my car, so, like, before I got up. So I got in my car, did the half hour journey to college, parked, then he jumped out of me from the back seat.
In order to
just to make me jump and scream and...
Tell him about the divan.
The van?
The bed.
Oh, the bed, that was me. So I found that he has a drawer under his bed. So I got my sister, when I wasn't living with them at the time, I went there when they weren't in, got my sister to push me in the drawer under their bed, and then I just waited there until I thought they were asleep and just started banging on the bottom of the bed.
I think there's a lot of affection here.
There is. There's a lot of planning.
I think there's a lot of transferred or projected affection in all of this. I think you have a very sound relationship with your dad.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
There's a lot of love in this.
It started because he accused me of wanting to give him a heart attack. Because I would just randomly jump out, like, silly things, like, as he came home from work, I'd be hiding behind the door. Mm. Or I'd jump out from over the fence. And then he'd... Then decided to go one further, and then, like, I think his first strike was something like, I'd gone to the bathroom in the morning, and he'd snuck into my bedroom and hid under the covers and popped out, and it was sort of from there.
I see.
Got more and more elaborate.
It's, yeah.
How often do you and your father hug?
We don't.
Ah.
How often do either of you say to each other, I love you?
We don't.
So you can see what it is. It's transferred affection. There's a great deal of affection there, but there's also a certain amount of constipation. Isn't that right? And I'm not charging for this, by the way, but I could, because I'm a qualified psychiatrist, as everyone knows. So that's what we've got there. Wouldn't you say, Kath?
Definitely.
As an amateur.
Gosh, definitely, yeah.
Yes.
I've never seen it quite that way before. I just thought it was a charming bit of horseplay, but yeah, you're right.
No.
You got to the... You got to that rather too quickly, though. Surely you got supposed to take 50 minutes, aren't you?
A psychiatrist hour. 50-minute hour, yes, yeah. And have a box of Kleenex on a little coffee table next to the patient. Yes, yes, yes. I'd love to do that, actually. Have you seen the Frasier episode where he gets dressed up as a clown and frightens his dad, Marty, so much that Marty ends up with a heart attack?
No.
It's exactly the same sort of thing. I strongly recommend it, and I'll find the episode for you, and you can have a look at it, and you can see your relationship with your father being worked out for what it is, which is, being a male relationship of this kind, besides being very affectionate, it's also very competitive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you flown the nest?
I did, but no, I'm back at the minute.
You're back at the minute, OK. Well, there's an awful lot of tensions there as well, aren't there? Because he's delighted to have you back, but at the same time, he has enormous urges as a parent to somehow kick you out.
Yeah.
So there's all of that going on there. It's quite complicated for him, I think, your dad.
Same, well, for me as well, because it's very irritating being my age and being forced to have to live with your parents again.
I know. I
remember that.
Fully understand. No, I don't, because I've never been there, but I think I can sympathise.
I remember. You go, you're an adult, you get used to that, then you're back living with your parents again, and in order to survive, you have to go back into that box of being someone's kid and leaving notes and saying when you're going to be back.
And it's the other thing as well, there are small frustrations that come when it's not your house.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep.
But do you know what? The frustrations are on their side too, because it is their house and the cuckoo is back.
Yeah.
Yes. I've noticed an enormous increase over the last 5 to 10 years in advertisements for hotel rooms. And it took a long while before a penny dropped for me, and that is as follows. When I was, when I went off to college, aged 18, I had my own place. I had my own room in a halls of residence, and then I had my own room in a flat with a bunch of other students. And then I got myself a little flat when I was 24. And so if, you know, the evening went as well as I hoped it would, then there were no difficulties about what was going to happen. But a penny suddenly dropped with me 3 or 4 years ago that there are an awful number of young men who live with their parents and young women who live with their parents. And if that's the case, and they want to show each other exactly how much they love each other, what's she going to do? You've got to go on Trivago.
Yeah, either that or you end up being very cosy with the parents quite quickly. I used to dread that. Coming down in the morning at someone else's house and sitting with their mum. No.
No.
You can't do that.
You don't really want to, do you?
No, and they don't like it either.
No. No. Mind you, that bit about, Sam, you saying about hiding underneath your dad's bed, being put in the drawer underneath his bed, just reminded me, I don't know if I've told you this, if I have, shut me up, but the most enjoyable practical joke I ever got to play on the radio was when I was working on a radio station that used to come off the air at midnight, but the transmitter was still up and running. All that happened was we went to silence. So at 12 o'clock I would say, and that's it, and El Gringo will be along with the breakfast show at 6 o'clock. And until then, silence. But what I'd said to people about 5 minutes before we went off the air was, I said, look, that's what I'm going to do, right? Get your transistor radio, sneak into your parents' bedroom, put the transistor radio underneath their bed, and sneak out again. So then I put the station off the air and went and sat around in the newsroom for about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. And then I went back in the studio and I just lifted the fader and I just went, hello. Hello. Now, sadly, I don't think anybody did it. If they did do it and it worked, they weren't ever kind enough to tell me that it was fantastic fun. But I tried.
Oh, how wonderful.
And, you know, with radio being what it is, all you can do is give it a try, and if it doesn't work, don't do it again. So I didn't. Right, well, this evening on the programme, we have been discussing at some length Putin, Salisbury and the whole business. And it's not going to go away because there will be twists and turns and pratfalls and pancakes, not pancakes, custard pies, in that story as the week goes along. It's Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee. But the other stories that we didn't really get much of a chance to digest this evening include Stephen Hawking saying before he died, well, obviously, that he believes that we should be exploring other worlds to live on because of the possible consequences for mankind of either a rogue asteroid hitting the Earth, climate change, or, he said, artificial intelligence. Now, when a man of his calibre says that it's quite possible that we could be outmanoeuvred by the machines in the not-too-distant future, he's saying, we shouldn't be thinking about this 200 years from now. We should be thinking about it now. It just makes you wonder, doesn't it? Do you have fears, Kath, that the machines will eventually start to recognise that we are redundant?
I don't know whether I believe in a sort of Terminator-type reality, but I think that humankind may be making itself obsolete work-wise, and maybe that will have implications.
Sam, do you have fears for the machines taking over?
No.
No,
to me it's all just film and fiction.
So you know better than Stephen Hawking?
Allegedly so, yeah.
You mentioned Terminator. There was a joke that a guy was doing on the circuit, which was, you know, Terminator landed next to a bar for Hell's Angels.
Yes.
And that's how he came to end up looking like that, because he borrowed the clothes, the boots.
Boots on your motorcycle.
Yeah. Well, this guy's joke was, he said, what would have happened if Terminator had come down and he was next to a circus, right? And he'd gone into the clown's tent and said, I want your boots, your clothes, and your unicycle. And I remember laughing enormously because it's such a good joke. I can't credit the comedian because I can't remember who it was. But also thinking that would have been much scarier.
Mm.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Terminator, dressed as Beppo.
Wow.
On a unicycle, going through Los Angeles with that, you know, 180-degree glass-eyed stare that he has, looking for John Doe. What was his name? John Connors. John Connors.
Sarah Connor.
Hmm.
Well, yes, because clowns are scary in themselves, aren't they?
Yes, they are. I used to have a joke guest. All I had was one of those horns that you get. That's the one. And I used to say, and with us on the show tonight, we've got Nikki, we've got Steve is here, we've got Lego as well, and also Beppo. Good evening, Beppo. You do that fantastically well.
Thank you.
Can I tell you, at home, you may be wondering, or walking along with the dog if you're podcasting this, that the sound effect that is being made at the moment is being made by a woman using only her vocal cords. Doesn't that propel you somewhere? Let's try it again. Good evening, Beppo. That is phenomenal.
I used to make that noise with various parts of my baby's bodies. Much to their amusement.
Phew, to the way that sentence ended.
Well, it has other applications.
Yes. Let's just try it again. Beppo, good evening. Are you up to being interviewed this evening? OK, remember, it's one for yes and two for no. So if the answer is yes, it's... And if the answer's no, it's... Well, Beppo, are you well? And have you had a good day so far? Are you getting exhausted?
I like how the eyebrows as well have to follow the sound effect.
Yeah, this is a woman who can do this.
I can't do it and laugh at the same time.
No, but I can't do it. Have you got any noises, Sam, that you can do?
Noises?
Like that, like a clown's hooter.
Not
that was me, I just did it then. Yay, come on.
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
I can do a wood pigeon. And I want to give this gift. My grandfather was a country man, taught me how to do a wood pigeon, and it's brilliant, and I am going to teach you how to do it if you can. Okay, ready? It goes like, it sounds like this.
Oh.
It's good, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I'm doing that with my mouth. Mm. With my mouth.
I can testify to that, yes.
Could you see any way, could you see how I was doing it? It's by looking at me. You have to sort of roll your tongue, like that. Can you make that noise? Okay. And then you close your mouth and you go. Who's that?
Me.
Me? Kath? Getting
not, it's a bit too harsh, mine. Yours is a lot softer.
The one that I've always wanted to do, I saw this really good-looking bloke in a bar. He was so good-looking, he didn't have to chat up the barmaid.
Oh.
He was that good-looking. She melted. When he said something, you know, like, he's like Joey out of Friends.
All right, I get
you. He just had to go, how you doing? And he didn't. He just went, pint of bitter, please. And the barmaid went, oh, yes, like that. And she brought in the pint of bitter and she was looking at him in a certain way and he just made this noise. And I've worked on trying to do it for 30 years. I can't do it. It was a tiger growl. It was just sort of, hold on.
Oh.
Yeah? No, I can't do it.
Like the one...
Like that.
Like the one Roy Orbison does in Pretty Woman.
Exactly that, yes.
Ow, hang on.
Ew, she can do it. She can do... These are the things that we learn to do at the back of chemistry or mm-hmm. maths when we're really, really squirming with boredom. We learn tricks like this, don't we?
I learned that noise from Eartha Kitt when she was Catwoman.
Eartha
she
Kitt.
Used to do that, didn't she?
Do it again?
Rawr.
Yeah. And you can't do any of these sort of verbal tricks.
No, I mean, I spend loads of time trying to imitate voices, but...
Can you not even do Chewbacca?
No, not very well. No. It just comes out.
Chewbacca is doable. That's Kath doing Chewbacca.
No, it's a bit deeper. It's like...
Are those... I think that was Chewbacca the younger.
It's Mrs. Chewbacca.
Yes. And all the little Chewbaccas. As a spin-off. Yes, I don't know if my George Galloway is any good, but I was listening this morning and he was trying to understand the concept of ant or deck. And he had a patient... I love George Galloway. Yeah, he had a patient producer who was working through the concept with him, because I don't think he's ever seen them or would admit it if he had.
That's the latter. I don't think there's a lot gets past Mr. Galloway.
Are they comedians, per se?
Yeah. He says some amazing things, of course, that's his job. But a couple of the phrases I really like are when he goes to an ad break.
Yes.
And he says, and no time for some capitalist messages.
No time for some capitalist messages.
He'll say, I smell trouble on the horizon.
I smell trouble on the horizon. You are saying this just to provoke me. But I think anybody could do George Galloway.
Well,
I don't think you need a particular skill for that. I do sometimes, if I'm really bored, turn to some of the YouTubes of John Culshaw, because that's phenomenal.
I find it fascinating, though.
Yeah, I mean, how anybody can do the Wogan roller coaster of the voice, where you go, hop in there, and then right down there. And Culshaw just does it. Like, you know, he is Wogan.
Mm-hmm.
And he also does some very nice noises as Ricky Gervais. Who can you do just as a noise? Bruce Forsyth you could just do as a noise. It doesn't require any, does it?
Apparently Chris Tarrant is a noise as well.
Yes. Like yeah. I was surprised but pleased that Clarkson is going to have a go at that Who Wants to Be a Millionaire programme.
Right.
I mean, Tarrant was very good at it, but Clarkson will certainly bring an edge to it, I think. Hopefully.
Definitely. It's kind of the same, I would imagine it's going to be the same kind of dynamic as the Anne Robinson Weakest Link thing.
Yes.
Where it's slightly terrifying, but it's panto.
Yes. What do we think of Pointless? It's become, as these things that go on before the news on BBC, stripped Monday to Friday, always do. It's become, you know, a gigantic institution.
It's Pointless, the Alexander Armstrong thing.
Yes, it is, yes.
Mm. Well, I've never been that bothered about quiz shows, really.
No, me neither.
That and the sort of the chase and all that stuff. And
my theory about quiz shows is that they are all aimed at people who believe that they were cleverer at school it was realised, but that nobody realised it, and so they still want to make up for it by shouting out the answers.
Oh.
I think that's the reason for it.
There might be something in there.
Well, you look at it. I mean, you get a person, usually a bloke, standing in front of a board with questions on it.
Huh? Right.
Where else? And sitting in front of him are people in desks. You look at virtually every quiz show that's out there, it is a stylized schoolroom.
Yeah.
Isn't it? So that's what it appeals to. People at home do it, don't they?
They do.
I always pretend I'm not trying.
Of course, but you're always delighted when you get one right?
I make sure I'm absolutely certainly right before I shout it out.
Embarrassing.
There's nothing worse than going, Delhi, and it turns out to be Kolkata.
Mm-hmm. Analyse this. My step-grandfather records countdown every day, and he watches it twice. And the second time he gets all the answers right. And he's so pleased with himself.
Does he do that?
Mm-hmm.
There used to be a bloke on the train up who used to do the Times crossword quicker than everybody else. And then it was discovered that he was just simply writing rubbish in it. He was a city gent type. And he would get out his silver biro and everybody would sit there with their Telegraph or Times crossword. And he would just go... And then apparently somebody found a copy of his paper that he'd left in the compartment one day, and it was just gobbledygook.
Gosh. Like the first kid to finish the exam and to stretch out.
Yes.
Self-satisfied.
Yes. Do you remember, did you take the 11 plus, either of you kids?
No.
I did.
Sam, you did? How'd you get on?
I passed, but it was only because of my age, because you get bonus points based upon where your birthday is in the year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it turns out that had I not been born in July, I would have failed.
Oh, man.
Really?
Yeah.
So they cut you slack for being a summer baby?
Yeah, because...
That's fair. I think that's fair.
Yeah. I think it is fair. I never got any slack. I was August.
Yeah. So, yeah, you obviously compare
it to... Sports days were the worst.
Yes.
Those kids were developmentally a year ahead of me.
I know. You go into junior, any junior football setup, and you'll find out that the first team is always consists of boys born in September, October, November. All right, but here's the scary bit. So does the England squad.
Of course. I was speaking to someone who was a head of development for one of the sports, and he said, you know, if you want to have a champion of the future, make sure you time that baby correctly.
September, yeah. I think there's only ever been one England footballer in the last 30 or 40 years was born in the summer month. That was Michael Owen.
Wow.
I'm Michael Owen, so I know what it's like to be injured. That's commercially
heard that,
does on another radio station. I know what it's like to be injured. You lie around on the sofa all afternoon having £30,000 bets on non-entity races from Pontefract and losing. Or something like that.
Just like that, Michael.
Yes, he is. Okay, we're rapidly heading towards Paul Ross time. Does Paul Ross like to come in and say
he
hello
does,
before
yeah.
he starts?
Have we got an advert first?
Oh, well, we'll do that then. We'll take
capitalist messages.
Capitalist messages.
The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Paul Ross, as I mentioned, joins us at 1 o'clock, Paul.
I wish I did join you. I wish I was sticking around and you were here with
that
us. Because, Tommy, it's been a dog's age since I've seen you.
Yeah,
you
it has
look
been
very
too
well
long.
Indeed.
So do you. You look younger.
Ish, do I? No wrinkles on a balloon, as my mother always says. Fit for purpose, we hope.
Whilst we were listening to those capitalist messages, sorry, we've been drawing on the pronunciation styles of George Galloway, we were talking about the fact that how extraordinary it is that our children with the same gene pools can be such chalk and cheese.
Absolutely.
And you've got a couple like that.
Yeah, well, I've got five children, a son by my first marriage, and four daughters. Their colouring's all very different. So I've got a blonde-haired one with blue eyes. I've got a brunette like their mum with brown eyes. Two did, in consecutive years, they studied Mandarin at Leeds University. One paid £3,000 a year. The next one had to pay £9,000 a year in fees.
Wow.
And the same course, the same lecturers, the same tuition.
Yeah.
Absolute disgrace. But one is very much committed to working for an NGO in China. She's doing an MA. She wants to get involved in basically recovering waste there. She's a vegan, very committed. The other, who is equally caring, but she's got a job and attachment with HSBC, is in China now, and they're paying to train her as a lawyer. So she's my pension fund.
Ah.
So I've got the capitalist and I've got the veganist.
You've got the capitalist and the veganist. How does it come about? We've speculated at home that it can be to do with the fact that when you're a sib, I was going to ask you if you've got brothers and sisters.
And that's why, though, I think I'm such a big-mouthed, deceitful, manipulative show-off.
Because?
Because I have no conscious memory of a time without younger siblings.
Yeah.
So brother number two came along when I was 18 months old. Then it was fairly regularly. Every 18 months.
Yeah.
And then I'm suddenly... So I've always had somebody to blame things on. I was a proxy parent. And I think the pecking order's kind of overlooked in people's personalities sometimes. It's not an excuse. I shouldn't be such a, you know, manipulative, deceitful person, but I am.
Well, you say that. I don't believe that's the case at all, but...
I've manipulated him.
Yeah.
In my capitalist way.
You knew he was going to say that.
But what I think is when you're the younger one, I was the eldest too, so I can't speak from experience. We're all the eldest.
Yeah.
There's something interesting in that. Are you the eldest, Sam? Sam's the eldest too. So what have we got here? I mean, there's something there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Do you not tell you
but
what
we're the alphas. That's what we've got here, the alphas. Whereas my youngest brother is very much the young prince, the little prince.
Yeah.
He was still he's in his late 40s, early 50s. He'll still go back indoors and change, even if all rating, if his trousers aren't hanging right.
Oh.
You see?
My sister, at the age of 37, is still the baby. Still gets a lot of slack for her, I think.
Is your mum still burping her?
Oh, pretty much, yeah. She would, she could.
Yeah, but you can be at a party where there are a bunch of siblings and they're all in their late 70s, early 80s, and you can quickly work out who the older brothers and sisters were because they sort of slap the youngest one around.
I don't think I dare do that with my brothers.
Well, verbally, sit down and be quiet. It's just stupid.
Yeah.
You know, you get to somebody who's 78, but 3 years younger than the other sibs.
It's curious, isn't it, the dynamic of all that?
Well, I think as a child you notice what gaps there are in the personalities of your older brothers and sisters, and you think to yourself, well, nobody's doing that, so I'll have a little go at that and see whether it works. And if it gets noticed and picked up on and applauded by both the sibs and the parents, then you think to yourself, okay, well, I've got, you know, there's a piece of something there that I can turn into gold dust in later life.
That is so, I've not thought of that before, but my dad always used to say to all of us, there'll be one thing in life that you're either really excited by or good at, and if you find that, that's happiness.
Go with it.
And we've all got something very different. And the brother between me and Jonathan, Simon, was always interested in fossils and rocks. And my dad kind of encouraged him and managed to get... probably nicked it, got an old cabinet somewhere for his samples. And he then did, and he went on and read geology. He doesn't use it now, but he did a PhD in geology. But actually, very early on, he wasn't trapped into it, but he was enthused by it and encouraged.
Yes.
My sister in football, I could never be doing with it. But I think my sister always was rather put out that my dad would always encourage me with reading and things. And so she couldn't get a look in there. But with football, because I wasn't interested, that was their time.
It's interesting. See, I put up a fence once. And the first paling that I put up was all over the place. It was wonky. It was rubbish. I expected it to fall down that afternoon. Second one I put up was a bit better. By the time I got to the bottom of the garden, I could fence for England. And I'm coming to think that parenting is a bit like that. And it's a shame in a sense that you only get one go. I know you might have three or four or five children, but you only ever have a go at being the father or the mother of those five children. Because it's not just the individuals that you're parenting, it's the dynamic between them and making all of that work and keeping everybody happy, keeping everybody amused and sorting out the, I'm going to say arguments, because there are always arguments.
And also living with their own problems and issues and challenges I don't know, financial worries or whatever it is going on in their own lives.
And then you almost got it right, and then they go.
Oh, but then they come back again.
Well, we talked about it earlier.
Oh, Sam's not a cuckoo in the nest, is he?
You haven't got grandchildren yet?
I've got two. Yeah, I've got an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Right. Now, is that as much fun as I'm hoping it's going to be if I ever get there?
It is, yeah, although it is that it's the way things change and are different. I mean, I remember doing things with my son when he was 11 or 12 and showing him, we shared movies together. I watched The Terminator with him when he was 11 or 12. Now, if I dared to suggest that I watched that with my oldest grandson, Reuben, I know I'd be persona non grata because they've got different views about what's suitable. Yeah. So maybe I was too lax and liberal, or maybe it was a different type. Videos had just arrived, it was all exciting, and the argument used to be, oh, Dad, well, if we don't watch it, I'll see it round at Stevie's.
Yeah.
So, you know, they play those games with you. But they are an absolute joy. And again, they're very different. Their interests are so different. One, the eldest is absolutely football bonkers. The other one, you can never get him off his bike. And even that basic difference.
Yes, yes, yes. And who does he support?
Like me, well, West Ham. I'm a fan, not a fanatic, because we grew up, they're still where I grew up, in Leytonstone.
Yeah.
So it's either Leighton Orient or West Ham, if you're from that part of the world. So I've known trouble and suffering in my life because of that.
I'm sure you have. And some very, very great days as well. Where are you on the Bobby Moore statue argument? Is it going to... Do you want it to go to the new stadium or stay where it's...
I think it should stay where it is, to be honest. I think it should be near the Berlin ground, because, absolutely, you know, that was... And he used to have a pub... walking distance, about 15 to it, called Moro's back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And the outside was done in that white Artex to be Moorish. Because of Bobby Moore. And most Saturday nights you would see him in there because his motto used to be, win or lose, on the booze.
He did like a pint,
didn't
he?
But, you know, I suppose back... And Jimmy Greaves and other... And Jimmy had problems later on, much more severe problems. But I suppose back in those days, they just thought, oh, we'll sweat it out in training. Very different times.
Yeah, apparently he used to put on bin liners, Bobby Moore, and he would be seen before anybody else had got to training. He'd stitch himself into some bin liners and then put a tracksuit top over
it. Built-in sauna.
And then go for yes, yes, so the story goes.
Oh, that's old school, with a vengeance.
Looking forward to hearing you after the news, which is coming up next, and talking to you at the same time tomorrow night.